You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphone!
And a phony at the mic! Whoa!
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this is a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
In 5, 4, 3, 2.
It's that time of the year for Dave Plyer's favorite conversations of the year on 720 WGN. And now, live from the Allstate Skyline Studios, here's Dave.
So nice of him to come in tonight and do that live.
Yeah, man, Duffy doesn't come in just for anyone.
No, he does not. No, he does not. No, nope. Only the bald awesome. People here.
Yeah, exactly.
How much did you? How much did you slide him?
That's a bottle of bourbon. Is all it was. That's all it was.
This is. I do love the next couple of weeks because we really culled together some great conversations tonight. Dennis Leary, comedian Dennis Leary, was talking about a new show that he was on. Actress Marion Ross from Happy Days just put out a new book and turned 90. Judd Apatow, he was with us, joining us to talk about the Gary Shandling documentary that that debuted over the summer, which is just spectacular. David Eigenberg and Christian Stolte from Chicago Fire. Bill Curtis, Walter Jacobson, we did right in the beginning of the year on the 45th anniversary of them at the news anchor desk together. And then we're going to pair some other things on our podcast with Journey's Jonathan Cain, Marty Croft, and our Loop tribute that we did. But first up, here is comedian Dennis Leary. So actor and comedian Dennis Leary is known for his Emmy-nominated work in FX's Rescue Me and films like Wag the Dog and The Ref. My kids loved him in The Amazing Spider-Man and Ice Age, and it's been 25 years since he released his first comedy album, No Cure for Cancer. He's also an author and is an avid supporter of our first responders with the Leary Firefighters Foundation. And he has joined the Season 3 cast of the hit drama series Animal Kingdom. Good morning and welcome in, Dennis.
Hey, how are you?
I am good, man. I'm good. Hey, I've been a fan since No Cure for Cancer, and maybe even MTV, the days of MTV and Remote Control. I can't believe it's been 25 years since that first album came out.
I know. Wow. Yeah, it has. It's been a long time.
So Animal Kingdom on TNT, great show, and now even better with you in it. You play, let's call him Drifter Dad, and you're married to Ellen Barkin, who is great on this show. How fun is this role for you?
Well, it was fun for me because I've met Ellen, but I'd never actually worked with her. And to go back even further in the time machine, when in 1980, when I had just graduated from college, and a bunch of the music students, guys who became, you know, professional musicians later in life, and some acting friends of mine were all working at this restaurant downtown in New York called Central Falls.
All right.
And she was a waitress there.
Oh, get out of here.
And yeah, so at the time, of course, we just thought, you know, it's the blonde waitress who doesn't talk to us. So listen, me and my friends, I would go in there with my other friends because late at night we could drink and eat appetizers for free after like midnight.
Oh,
that's
nice.
Why we went there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because our buddies were all working as bartenders and
sure.
waiters there.
Yeah.
She was a waitress, and she never talked to us. So it took this long until I was on the set with Ellen, where I finally went, hey, listen, you know, blah, 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 what I just told you. And she said, I remember you guys, because you guys were so loud and so rowdy, I was afraid.
Seriously.
Of you.
Seriously,
like, oh
she remembers that. That's awesome. That's awesome.
She remembered that.
And that's the first time, and so working with her, I mean, this is the first time you even ever met her then.
No, I'd met her. We'd done charity events together. But, you know,
okay.
people don't realize sometimes when you do, you know, big press events and award shows and charity events, you know, you meet people and you might work with them. You might present something on stage. But, you know, it's so insane and busy that you don't get a lot of time downtime to talk to everybody, you know. So I actually knew her husband, Gabriel Byrne, better than I knew her. So I did talk to Ellen right after they made the offer to me, and I started thinking about it. I talked to Ellen about, you know, how they worked and what the process was like on Animal Kingdom. And one of my best friends I play hockey with, who's a huge Animal Kingdom fan, had been talking about the show for a long time. My wife is a fan. My daughter was a fan. So I was aware of the show and interested in working with Alan and as well the four young actors who play the sons and the grandson. And the part was really interesting and sort of a challenge. And so I dove in, took the opportunity.
It's a great show. I mean, I've enjoyed it the last couple seasons. I mean, it's a lot of fun to watch. There's a lot of twists and turns in this thing. And as soon as I saw your face in the preview, I just honestly, I thought to myself, what a perfect fit into this show.
Yeah, I mean, I think the character is, first of all, when John Wells, who's the creator, called me and told me what the part was, I said, well, I mean, that kid Jake Weary, who's I'm yeah. playing Darren's
yeah.
Dad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a perfect matchup physically in terms of how we look. But, you know, the other thing you have to remember is I was coming in, the plot line this season, you know, Smurf is in jail.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the reason my character shows up is because he knows she's not going to be around, and he decides to come in and take over the family. So my first, you know, couple of episodes, all I'm doing is working with those four young actors, and they're really good.
That's great. Yeah.
And obviously they've been playing these guys for a couple of years.
Sure.
They're way up to speed. They improvise with each other. You know, they're sort of old pros at it. So it was a little scary the first couple of days when I got there and I realized, oh, my God, you know, I'm surrounded by four really talented young actors who
That's
already
great.
Have this thing down.
Yeah.
So I really had to bring my A game.
Well, and this gave you an opportunity to work on the same network as Kevin Reilly, who's the president now of TNT. But way back, he was the head of FX where Rescue Me was greenlit.
Kevin was the guy. I first met Kevin when we had written the scripts, the first couple of scripts for Rescue Me, and
yeah.
we were looking for a home, myself and Peter Tolan,
right.
Who was my co-creator on that, we got a phone call from Kevin Reilly saying, listen, I'm running FX, but I'm about to leave, and I hired this guy who's a friend of mine, who I think is a genius, John Landgraf.
Mm-hmm.
I want you guys to come in and meet him. And we said, why would we come in and meet this guy? Why would you call us when you're leaving? You know? And he said, you have to come in and meet the guy who's taking over.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we went in and met the guy, and, you know, he was a grand slam for us. And, you know, I stayed in touch with Kevin, and
that's cool.
I spoke to him right before I took the part. And listen, the show, it was an easy yes for me. Between Alan and those actors and the I like the show. I love the, I mean, there's a lot of great acting scenes, and there's hints of comedy within the
sure.
drama, but it's very dark, and it's got great action sequences. So when John was telling me about what my character was going to be doing, one of the things I do is design one of the biggest heists they've ever done on the show, and I was like, this is like, it reminds me of Rescue Me. You have
it
great
does.
Drama.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have moments of really dark comedy, and then these big action sequences, which are a blast, you know?
Let me tell you, Rescue Me was, I'm a loyal fan, always was, and for a decade, my go-to shows were The Sopranos and Rescue Me, those two favorites. But I got to tell you, I really love The Job. I'm going to go back even further a little bit. I love The Job on ABC. I know that was a long time ago, but that was well-written, man.
Yeah.
It was funny.
We love that show.
Yeah.
But listen, man, The Sopranos is my favorite drama of all time.
Yeah.
And that character that Jim Gandolfini created, I just think that's one of the greatest acting monuments in the history of television.
Sure.
So the fact that you're mentioning Rescue Me with that show means a lot to me.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's cool. And we're living in this world, speaking of politics, we're living in this world of political correctness, and it's kind of taking the fun out of everything. But really, do you think that climate of political correctness right now is kind of slowly killing comedy a little bit?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's funny you're mentioning that, because I was just talking to somebody about that the other day. You know, I do two live concerts a year for a charity. One's for the Cam Neely Foundation up in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is for the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the Parkinson's
right.
Foundation.
Yep.
And both events, you know, one is 25 years old, the Cam Neely event, and Mike's event now is in its 18th year. Mm-hmm. Both those guys, Mike Fox and Cam, from the beginning said, I want the comedians to have, you know, complete free reign. You can talk about whatever you want.
That's great.
Now, over the years, I've had everybody you can think of on these shows with me. And, you know, it's clear, like, when I come out, or Dave Chappelle, or Jon Stewart, or Amy Schumer, you know, whoever it might be, if you already have the notoriety, they'll go with you anywhere. They'll let you push the envelope.
Okay.
They might gasp a little bit, but they know who you are and what you're supposed to do.
Sure.
The problem is for younger comedians trying to go out and push the envelope in clubs. Now everybody's got their phone out. So if you say something contrary,
that's,
you know,
so
when
true.
When you're developing new material, you push the envelope. You got to go way over the line to find out how far over the line you can actually go without really bumming people out.
Right? You're right. The cell phone has ruined this, too. You're totally right about the cell phone. Yeah.
So what happens now is you do it, and then it's on Twitter, and people are, you know, calling you out for it. And then that young comic can't get a gig because the club owner doesn't want
right.
to hire somebody.
Take a chance.
Yeah. So it's – and listen, I think half of it is one of the reasons people are at each other's throat right now, is you can't say anything or do anything without somebody going, yeah, you know, but what about, you know, the people whose feelings you're hurting?
Yeah, right.
Well, listen, man, comedy is about hurting somebody's feelings somewhere.
It's just so true,
And that Michelle Wolf thing, when she was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Now, listen, I wasn't there, but I saw the videotape of it. She had some unbelievable material. She also pushed some buttons that may have been considered over the line. But you know what? The ultimate person who speaks truth to power is the comedian. Because the comedian doesn't have a political party. You know
what
I mean?
That's true. That's true. That's true.
If you start shutting down comedy, then we're really in trouble.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you come from the comedy school kind of George Carlin and Richard Pryor. Would they give a damn about political correctness that's out there right now?
No. One of the great things about those guys was... And I'm not calling anybody to task. I'm just speaking from my own personal taste.
Yeah.
I feel like all you're going to do is go out and make anti-Trump jokes. And believe me, there's a ton of them in that book. And if I was on stage tonight, I'd have, you know, at least 5 minutes of material about what went on the last couple of days. Right?
Sure,
that's
of
what
course.
You do as a comedian.
Yeah.
I get a little tired when the political comedian's on stage and all they do is make jokes supporting one point of view. I just think that's not what Richard Pryor did. That's not what George Carlin did. It's not what any of the great political comedians did.
It's not even what Johnny Johnny Carson did. I mean, he kind of kept it in the middle as much as he could, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You should be hitting both sides. And Jon Stewart used to hit both sides. So on The Daily Show. So to me, one of the things I always loved about Carlin was he had no political persuasion. He was just constantly speaking out against all religion, including the one he was brought up in,
that's right.
Catholicism.
Yeah.
But generally, he was speaking funny truth to power, you know. It's funny you mentioned those two guys. Those are my two heroes, George Carlin and Richard Pryor. I think Pryor was hands down the greatest comedian of all time just because he had all the tools. I mean, he could do impressions, but he could also do physical.
Yeah.
And George Carlin is a close second. So to me, that's like the Babe Ruth and, you know, Lou Gehrig of comedy. Those two guys. And I don't think you could. I'd met George Carlin and
that's cool.
Richard Pryor. I don't think I could tell you which political party they voted for during their lifetime.
Yeah, me neither. And when you mention those two guys, a lot of people will mention Bill Cosby too. And now it's kind of hard because Bill Cosby was such an inspiration to so many, and The Cosby Show, and, you know, just convicted of some pretty slimy stuff. And, you know, you almost wonder if comedy will even remain a piece of his legacy anymore.
No, I don't think it is, man. I think I think that's over, you know. I mean, one of the beauties of Richard Pryor's life, who died far too young, when you look at what he talked about on stage, his greatest material was almost always this incredible soul bearing, including when he set himself on fire. So everything that happened to the guy, even shooting up his wife's car, everything that happened was grist for the mill, and it was completely, purely honest, which is one of the reasons we laughed at it so hard. I look at Bill Cosby now, who was a great comedian. It was one of the all-time great stand-up comedians. And you just kind of go,
Right, yeah.
Missing a big chunk there.
Yeah. Know? Well, you led a one-man Jell-O boycott a couple years ago. I remember that.
Yeah, well, listen, he was one of those guys. Whatever you want to say about Cosby, in the 90s, after I took off and Chris Rock, and I'm trying to remember, I think the third was Sam Kinison.
Yeah.
He made a statement at that time about the three of us and how the language that we used was...
I remember that.
And I was just like, really? You're going to call out me and you know, Chris and Sam Kinison? Now I look at it and I go, really?
Yeah. right.
We were using too many F-bombs, but you were, you know, dropping roofies into people's drinks.
Yeah, All right. That's right. Yeah.
You know?
And now that you're 60, you really can say and do whatever you want now. I mean, that's the best part of this whole thing.
Oh, I say it to my kids all the time. I say it to my kids all the time. I say, if they say, oh, there's this thing, there's this great new restaurant, and I go, can you wear jeans and a t-shirt? No, you have to wear a sport coat. Not going. Okay? I'm not going. I literally have not worn a tie except to this one wedding of my niece's. I have not worn a tie in 5 years.
I can't see in a tie.
Yeah, I'm very Ted Williams when it comes to the tie thing. And remember Babe Ruth? He never wore a tie either.
That's true.
And I'm not saying I'm as good as those guys. I'm just saying I like their style. You know what I mean?
That's awesome. That's awesome.
I wear jeans and t-shirts, and that's it
and
for
that's
the rest
it.
Of my life.
That's
and,
right.
And by the way, you're lucky I'm wearing that, because usually it's just I'm in my bathing suit and flip-flops. That's the outfit.
That's
really,
it, huh?
Okay?
Right.
With some kind of hockey t-shirt. That's about as far as I go.
I'm good with that. You can do whatever you want. It's okay. It's all right. Before I let you go, hey, I want to talk about this We Can Be Heroes event you just did, the second annual Dennis Leary FDNY Firefighter Challenge. And for those who don't know about this foundation, you really do great work for our first responders. Share a little bit about your most recent event, a little bit about your foundation, Dennis.
Well, what we do is I started the foundation, it's almost 20 years ago now. My cousin Jerry Lucy was a firefighter in my hometown in Worcester, Massachusetts, right in our old neighborhood. It was his life's dream. He was killed in the line of duty in December of 1999. Mm-hmm. And I started the foundation because he was a big proponent of, training facilities, new vehicles, and new equipment for his fire department and fire departments in general, because the fact that firefighters don't go on strike in almost every urban setting in America means that they're constantly getting their budgets cut. And that's just the truth.
Yeah, it is.
So I started the foundation to help the Worcester Fire Department after my cousin's death. And one of my best friends had become a firefighter in New York. And after 9/11, we moved in to help the families of the 343 firefighters who were killed during 9/11. And from there, we started to help the FDNY build a high-rise simulator, which they didn't have for their training facility. So we built a building for them.
Yeah, how critical is that?
Allows them. It's really. And so, I mean, now we're at the point where, thank God, almost 20 years later, we're so successful that every year we're like last year with this event, we helped 10 different departments all over the country to get new trucks. And
yeah, I saw that. I saw the trucks online. Yeah, that's very cool.
So what we do is, we call it We Can Be Heroes, because I'm a huge David Bowie fan, and his estate was nice enough to give us the rights to the song and those lyrics. So it's called We Can Be Heroes, and it's my foundation, the Leary Firefighters Foundation, and the FDNY Foundation. And what we do is we get celebrities to come in with corporate sponsors and anybody who wants to pay into the pot, and you get to come to the FDNY training facility, The Rock, here in New York, and spend the day being a firefighter and going through the actual maneuvers.
That's great.
Going into live fire and smoke, a subway simulator, you get hose training, you rappel from the side of it. It's very active.
Yeah.
It's very real. And people, this is our second year, people love it. This year we had John Slattery go into fire.
I saw that.
Maura Tierney. Steve Buscemi was there, who's an ex-member of the FDNY.
Did not know that. Celebrity coaches. Okay.
So it's a really great day, for everybody who's involved. And, our deal is, within 6 months to a year of us getting our donations, we can show you a truck or a building or a piece of equipment that is actually being used by a firefighter that was paid for by your dollars, because the need is so great. Once you build the building or have the truck delivered or buy a piece of equipment and hand it to them, they start using it in real fire circumstances.
No, I've seen it. I've seen it all over Facebook and on your website too. I mean, you're throwing trucks out there all the time, and you're right. Some of these small communities haven't replaced trucks in 20 years, and their equipment's outdated.
Well, you know, it's also
crazy.
It's really, what's really amazing is that sometimes it's even, you know, in cities like Boston where they needed a fireboat. You know, their old fireboat was 30 years old. After Katrina down in New Orleans, a lot of their firehouses were destroyed. So we went down to help rebuild the firehouses and found out that they didn't have fireboats.
Wow.
So we ended up buying 16 boats for them.
Wow.
I mean, here's the other thing.
Yeah.
If you tell people that you want help raising money for firefighters, firefighters are always in the top three groups of people that are loved when they poll people about who do you most admire. So when you tell people, I need money to help firefighters, people really respond from their heart and their wallet because they care about them so much.
But here's about your foundation, because I've been following it for years and I've donated to it before, is that you put your money where your mouth is. I mean, the money goes out just as much as quick as it comes in, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, we don't. You know, that speaks more less to my good work and more to the need, because once we ask a department, what do you need? Every single fire department, big town and small town, you know, urban giants like the FDNY or the Boston Fire Department, as well as small town fire departments, they all have a need. So it's great. It's a really great feeling to be able to take the money and, you know, in some cases, only a couple months later, turn over a vehicle. And then these guys send us videos back of them using it the day that they get it.
No, that's cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Great work, man.
All right, thanks, man.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right.
All right, bye-bye. Top stories are next on 720 WGN.
Dad, there are plenty of ways that we can help out, even if you don't want us to get jobs.
What ways? Name one way.
Well, we could,
well, there are just all kinds of ways.
All right, come on, Marion, let's hear it.
Well, tell him, Mom.
There's nothing. Now it's going to cost me $20 to clean the carpets.
I'll clean it for $10.
Never mind, I'll clean it. Now, Howard, there's just all kinds of ways we could take in a boarder.
Another mouth to feed, Marion.
No, we don't have to feed him.
Oh, great, we'll have a dead body on the staircase.
Wait a minute. The boarder doesn't have to eat with us. He doesn't have to live with us.
No, he could stay in a motel. I don't think he'll pay us much, though, Marion.
Monday, Monday, happy days.
All the harebrained, irresponsible
things. Harebrained?
I've got to be in a meeting in a half an hour, and I don't have any dinner, and I've got a limp fez.
Marion, do this. Marion, do that. You want your dinner? I'll get your dinner. You got it. I'll get your dinner. Thank you a thousand times. I can do it with my eyes closed. He is your salad, your vegetable, your meat. Limp it up!
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So before she was affectionately known to millions as Mrs. C on TV's Happy Days, Marion Ross began her career as a Paramount starlet who went on to appear in nearly every major TV series of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And soon came that fateful phone call from producer Gary Marshall that made her an overnight success and changed her life. In Marion's new book, My Days, Happy and Otherwise, Marion's story is one of inspiration, persistence, and gratitude. And to share that journey with us, Marion Ross joins us once again tonight. Marion, how are you?
Well, I am so well. Isn't that extraordinary? I think that's my Midwest, being raised in the Midwest.
I think it is. Very grounded, you are.
Yeah. Well, and we had those tough winters,
you know,
Minnesota, in Albert Lee, Minnesota.
You did. You absolutely did. And you know what? I was looking at this. You had your first regular TV role in 1953, which means you're celebrating 65 years in television. And dare I say, you have a big birthday coming up.
Oh, I do. It's just shocking because I'm going to be 90 years old.
Which is incredible. You know, and I gotta tell you, I've seen pictures of you at events and stuff. You look fabulous. You really do.
We do make an effort. You know, we make it. In fact, I'm at the beauty parlor right now getting all the gray hair taken away.
Oh, that, yes, that beautiful red hair.
I always had Ronnie Howard red hair.
You did. Know? Yeah, you always have. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, I really love this book, Marion. I knew, you know, as a fan and a friend about your career, but not so much about, you know, personally and growing up and so forth. And the book is beautifully and honestly told.
Well, you know, because my brother Gordon was a little crippled boy. He was born with a very bad leg, and they had to take his leg off below the knee when he was 16. So I think a great deal contributes because of him. In fact, I told him that one time when I was all grown up and successful. I said, I owe everything to you. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't be me. I wouldn't be what I turned out to be. And he said, he didn't see it that way. But I said, no, because I was so strong and healthy, and I had to make up for, I felt, a lot of what he was missing, you know?
Wow, that's very cool. And I know you also kind of credit your son with putting this book together, too, because, you know, I've heard you tell stories, and I always kind of thought in my mind, gosh, why hasn't she written a book yet? But your son kind of encouraged you to put it all together, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to write a book. No. And Jim said, no, Mother. In fact, I'm bringing you this man who's coming to the house. He's great. And I said, really? Yeah, so that'll be swell. And lo and behold, David Laurel, he would get me talking. You know, he'd get me talking, had this tape recorder. Because if you had asked me to sit down and write a book, I'm not a writer.
Yeah.
I'm not a writer.
Yeah.
You know?
But you can tell great stories. And I know you start this book with really talking about your childhood. And you can honestly say you really did have a pretty happy childhood growing up.
Well, I did, didn't I? I didn't know that, you know?
Yeah.
But I had such, first of all, I'm the second little girl. I'm the middle child. Mm-hmm. Are you a middle child?
I'm the oldest. Yeah, I'm the oldest out of two.
You're the oldest.
Yeah.
I see. So I sometimes being the middle child, second little girl, I had to work really hard to get, and then a crippled brother, to get any attention at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to be so damn cute, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you were always seeking, and I read this, you were always seeking your dad's attention, right?
I know.
Yeah.
I was aware.
Yeah.
At a very young age that people were watching me. Then I'd get cuter than ever.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's something that really inspired you pretty young, that you wanted to get kind of into this business.
I wanted attention. And yet I'm a very modest person, but I still wanted attention. If you don't mind, it would be like, look at me.
Yeah.
Will you look at me?
Yeah, yeah.
I will kill myself up on that stage if you will just watch me.
Yeah.
It's so pathetic. I thought, if I could outgrow that, need.
Well, you know,
I never did.
My daughter's a middle child, and I know that's exactly how she feels sometimes. She really has to wrangle us in to get her attention. She's got a much older brother. She's got a much younger brother. And so that kind So I think I get what you're saying there. And I know when you were younger, too, you didn't really have a TV in the house, but you were very entertained by theater magazines, movie magazines, radio and theater specifically. But as a young girl in Minnesota, acting was something, and as you said, was something you were always thinking about doing.
Oh, yes. But it was the movie. We went to the movies.
Yeah.
But one of the first books, I don't know if you are familiar with Noel Coward. Some people aren't.
Okay.
No. Oh, it's a great English playwright.
Yeah.
Song and dance man. It's fabulous. So one of the first books I would read when I went to the library was his autobiography. And he was like, in England, 6 or 7 years old, starting in show business. I was already 13, 14. So I thought, I've got to get going.
Wow, that's awesome. That provided some good inspiration, because I know you also, you know, spent a lot of time in the library too, talking about reading Who's Who's books and trying to understand how people got from where they started to where they were, right. Because you wanted that kick to know what you needed to do to get to that next level.
Yeah. Now all of a sudden they're famous. Well, what happened?
I love that. I know. I love that.
I love that you've actually read the book.
I did.
My friend. That's wonderful.
I did. Absolutely. Well, I was going to say, you were in the seventh grade production of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And as you said, your family did move around a lot, and you didn't always find the place that you were living, the atmosphere, that appealing. But you would always find refuge in the movie theater.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I would read autobiographies of actors.
Yeah.
But movies, of course, they only change the movie like every 2 weeks.
Right.
So that movie, I would cherish it so much and play it over and over in my head. You know, it was wonderful. Wonderful. Now we are inundated with entertainment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we are, aren't we? Yeah. There's just too much to choose from.
Too much.
Yeah.
It was terribly special. And the movie magazines, the movie stars in those days, we don't have that anymore,
no,
do we?
No, not that. Maybe on the Oscar night, but not the glamour that really existed back in the day. No.
Yeah. And if you look at those beautiful photographs of the stars, there wasn't a mark that shouldn't be there. It was all retouched. They were perfection. They were gods, you know?
Yeah, they absolutely were back then.
And you know, what's interesting in my book is that I got to work with, I have a picture with Clark Gable. I have a picture with Cary Grant. I thought the pictures were great in that book.
It really kind of told the story of what you were doing, because I was looking at this. You know, you obviously went to study drama at the MacPhail Center of the Arts. You went to San Diego University, and you got married. You moved to Hollywood early on, you know, as you were trying to make it big there in Hollywood, and you eventually got a studio contract at Paramount. You know, you dealt with some struggles, you know, with your husband at the time and alcohol and you know, having a drink and smoking in the 50s wasn't that uncommon, but this was probably a little over the top.
Oh, no, everybody's smoking.
Yeah.
And because I've come from a Scotch Presbyterian father, there was very little drinking, so I wasn't drinking. I didn't think that was going to be a problem for anybody.
Right.
Well, so I found out, didn't I?
You did. But, you know, you still, you know, with that said, you still forged forward. You were talking about some of the icons that you worked with, along with Ginger Rogers, William Holden, you know.
Yeah.
And you played an Irish maid very early on. And I love this because, you know, you think about the Brooklyn Bridge days. You played an Irish maid on Life
with
Father.
I like doing accents.
Yeah.
I could do an Irish accent. And I like with Father. I love that. We did it live at CBS.
Yeah, right.
With Leon Ames and Lorraine Tuttle live. You know, no mistakes. There it was. So I was always I would love to imitate the way people talked.
Yeah.
If I listened. In fact, I would, when I was like in the third grade, there was a girl that, you know, she had the really cutest little way of speaking. She just, it was so cute, and I thought, so immediately I imitated that, and the next thing I know, we were both sent to a remedial speech class.
Oh, you know? That's awesome. That's great.
I snapped out of it right away, but
she's there to this day, I suppose.
Yeah, that's cool. No, that's cool. And that was very early television, too. I mean, and I was reading this at Life with Father, even though it was broadcast in black and white, they actually kind of broadcast it in color but no one had a color TV back then.
I guess, yeah. When you get to be as old as I am, it's like this industry. In fact, when I was at Paramount, it was so, and I was 22 years old,
yeah.
23, under contract to Paramount. Everybody, all the big stars were there on the lot.
Crazy.
I mean, at lunchtime, Marlene Dietrich would come swooping into the commissary.
Wow.
C.B. DeMille was in this little alcove around the corner. I mean, it was all happening. Edith Head was head of the wardrobe department. And you would go up there, and Edith Head would pick out something for you to wear.
Wow.
You know? And so it was thrilling.
Yeah, thrilling back then. Absolutely. And you did your share of not only movies under contract, but you also did a ton of television. I was looking at this. Donna Reed, Burns and Allen, Father Knows Best. The Glenn Miller story, you played a mail order bride in an episode of Rawhide, The Fugitive, the Outer Limits, Operation Petticoat with Cary Grant and Tony Curtis, the original Hawaii Five-O, The Brady Bunch. But like other young actors and actresses, you had a list of both struggles and successes, right?
Absolutely. It's not, I hope everybody knows, it's not an easy business. Not
no.
easy, children.
No.
You know?
No.
And
no.
I would watch some of these actresses making time, you know, and getting ahead of me. And I would think, but I was so well brought up. I was so careful with myself.
Sure.
So that's why it took me a long time to really get established. I was like, I was in my early 50s with Happy Days, you know?
That's crazy.
Because I was so careful with my life.
Sure. Well, you know, and then the late 60s, you got divorced. Now you've got kids, you got finances, you know, you got a home to pay for. And you essentially kind of had to start over. And I know you had a friendship with Sandra Gould, who was Mrs. Kravitz from Bewitched.
Yes.
And she kind of told you about this pilot that was happening. And it was the new family in town, which was a prelude to Happy Days, of course.
Yes. On Love American Style. So I owe her a great deal, and she had me come over for dinner and the casting woman, and simple as that.
Wow. You know? Wow. Amazing how that happens.
But you know, when I look back at my life, I was helped. I was constantly being helped by people.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Yes, good friends, and great family too. And, you know, it was really a dream come true because, you know, the 1950s were pretty popular with American Graffiti and the theatrical play Grease, and ABC picked up this show with a slightly modified cast from the original pilot. And then you had Ronnie Howard and Henry Winkler, the late Tom Bosley. What an amazing experience that must have been to get that role.
Well, it was. Of course, we had no idea that it was going to turn into this phenomenal success. It was only after, I think we'd been on like a year and a half, and then finally the young producer called us all in. And he said, "You've all got to cooperate because we have a hit on our hands."
And you went live in front of a live audience because you were taping that show a little bit more as a one camera kind of show with a laugh track, and now you're going in front of a live audience when the show really took off. But I think about this now. You mentioned earlier about how much entertainment there is out there to watch, but at that time there were 25 million people every week watching that show.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now you'll see the ratings. You get a 5 or something. We had 22. We always got, everybody was watching Happy Days, and then they would go to school and talk about the show the night before,
Yeah, it's all water cooler.
You're a wonderful, interviewer. Oh. Young man.
Well, thank you, Marian. Thank you, dear. Thank you. Well, and I was looking at this: 11 seasons, 254 episodes. You know, it was an iconic show. Time and time again, you've been voted one of TV's favorite moms. That's got to be a very cool thing.
It's a very comfortable feeling. No matter where I go, there is somebody that will come up to me and say something so nice to me. I'm very appreciative of all of that. Yeah,
sure. Ron Howard wrote the foreword to your book, which I found apropos because in this book, you know, you talk about the early days in your life. I love the way this book kind of flows. And you talk about the people who were special in your life almost by chapter. And it's kind of a Q&A that goes through people talking about their experiences with you. So you get Henry Winkler, you get Donnie Most, you get Anson Williams, Scott Baio, and of course, your children. I thought that was very well very well done, and people
and my personal assistant too.
Yeah, Gwen.
She wrote a chapter. Gwen.
Yeah, Gwen.
So it's a it's fun, and now it's coming out, so I can move on, right? I think I can enjoy my retirement.
Yes, you absolutely. Yeah, and I know that you. But you know, before you did all that, you did Brooklyn Bridge. You were Drew Carey's mom on the Drew Carey Show, Nurse Jackie, Grey's Anatomy, The Middle.
Oh God!
Right. I mean, yeah. You know, you deserve to take a little respite now and enjoy yourself without having to go on one more audition, right?
Absolutely, and it's funny. That you do get satisfied, and I'm very willing to quit. You know, very willing. I don't mind one bit. And so somebody will say, "Oh, look at what one of your pals is doing." I'll say, "Good, good for her."
I love that. I love that.
Go get them.
Go get them. Go get them. Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. But you know, again, you know, and you also touch upon, and I don't want to be remiss in mentioning this, but of course, you talk about one of the loves of your life, Paul, who passed away back in 2011.
Yeah. My darling, Paul Michael. Yeah.
And what a special relationship that you had, and it's a really touching piece of this book.
Yeah, and you'll see pictures of Paul in the book too. So, it's a good life now. Paul is gone, but I'm enjoying my family and just having a good time.
Well, we've only touched upon a few of the stories in Marian Ross's new book. It's called My Days, Happy and Otherwise, available on Amazon and your local bookseller. And if you'd like to look back at the iconic 70s sitcom about the 50s Happy Days, the first six seasons are all available on DVD as well. Marian, you know, you were one of my first interviews 6 or 7 years ago, and I have to say it is always a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you so much. I love talking to you, honey. It's just wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks so much. All right, bye-bye now. It's 720 WTF.
I think, is there anything else, Judd, seriously?
I'm writing jokes with my friend Judd.
You know, for 25 years, he was the most important mentor that I had. But in a lot of ways, he was a mystery to me.
None of these journals are the same. And it reflects from the time I was 25 till now.
We go back to her place. I'm on the couch and I'm really getting into it. And she comes into the room.
Gary told an audience, "Don't worry, folks. You're going to feel good by comparison when I leave the stage."
My mother wants to marry me. I told my shrink that, and he did something I've only seen blackjack dealers do. He looked at me and he went...
It's Gary Shandling's show.
This is the theme to Gary's show.
Gary was always about topping his next thing.
Oh, the Spanish station.
Every time he went on TV.
You're like a mother to me. Do you know that?
I wouldn't breastfeed you, but other than that, I think that...
That made it hard to do the Tonight Show gig. Can you imagine if you had to top yourself every night?
Larry Sanders.
I hate this show.
Well, it's almost over, isn't it?
I hate this show.
Brad Grey dropped him as a client, and that opened up a huge can of worms.
The network is just using me as a negotiation tool.
If there is an element of betrayal or dishonesty, a lot of friendships were just dropped.
he turned to Buddhism, but it's not because he's Zen. It's because he was in desperate need of being Zen.
I'm still single. I've been single my whole life. eHarmony just matched me up with a gun.
Your material is purely a vehicle for you to express your spirit.
So it doesn't have any value beyond that?
It doesn't have any value beyond you expressing yourself in a very soulful, spiritual way. It's why you're on the planet.
Well, I looked in the mirror the other day. I thought, my God, I'm turning into Gary Shandling. And I did not see that coming, Judd.
Here's what I'm saying. I'll let the whole thing go for like two installments of $9.95. That's really where I'm at. And then here's what you get, though. My entire f***ing life.
When legendary comedian Gary Shandling passed away in 2016, he was widely remembered as a top stand-up comic and the star of two of the most innovative sitcoms in TV history. But to those who knew him, the real Gary Shandling was a far more complex person. Now, Judd Apatow has created a remarkable portrait of this iconic comedian in a 4.5-hour HBO documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. The debut is Monday, March 26, and to talk about the docuseries is director Judd Apatow. Judd, welcome in, my friend.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of your work and a longtime fan of Gary since the very first appearance on The Tonight Show in 1981. I was one of those kids that couldn't wait till he guest hosted. Like when I heard guest host Gary Shandling, I absolutely loved it. I mean, he's legendary.
Yeah, I mean, he really is one of the great comic minds of all time because he was a brilliant stand-up and also, you know, one of the real innovators of television comedy. He changed, you know, sitcoms two times, once with its Gary Shandling show and then with the Larry Sanders show.
Yeah, Larry Sanders, I still say, one of the top comedies ever to be on television. And I'm really thrilled because I got to watch this yesterday, Judd, and, you know, it's 4.5 hours and I was wowed by it, and it went by so fast, but the story is so beautifully told between the audio and video, the diary pages, his friends, you know, making his journey through his childhood, the loss of his brother, and really throughout his entire career. I just thought it was so beautifully told.
Well, I appreciate that. I got very lucky. I hired the editor of the movie Jane about Jane Goodall, who also edited the movie Montage of Heck about Kurt Cobain. And he really was a brilliant collaborator. The movie is very cinematic. We hired the composer who does a lot of our movies, Mike Andrews. You know, so it's really engaging in a way that, you know, that we had hoped for.
And you first met Gary, which I didn't know this, and learned a lot, of course, from this documentary, that you met him at when you were 16 years old at your high school radio station. You got him for an interview.
Yeah, I was obsessed with comedy when I was a kid, and I created a radio show just so I could meet people. And
awesome.
I interviewed Gary over the phone. He was in Las Vegas. He had just hosted The Tonight Show for the first time. This was in 1983.
Okay.
And that was a giant deal. They very rarely let a young person host the show. They let David Letterman do it, and Jay Leno got to do it. And so it's funny because in the documentary, when we're talking about that time, the interview is with me as a child.
That's very cool. Oh, I love how that all started. And you tell this story. You know, first of all, Gary wrote in his diaries, was so telling about how he was always forging forward with his goals. And I just found it fascinating that really, I mean, every goal he pretty much made for himself, he accomplished in pretty short term. There was some great insight into him, but he was very methodical about his life and how he wanted it to flow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he came from an engineering background. That's what he studied in college. And then at some point, you know, he got bored and started thinking about doing something more creative. And he took some creative writing classes. But I think he looked at a lot of his career as an engineer with the work ethic of an engineer. And then I think from an early age, he had an interest in Eastern religions and Buddhism. He had a He had a foreign exchange student live with his family for a year from Japan. And I think that's when he learned about Buddhism as a kid.
Yeah, very spiritual all throughout his life. And one of those things that, you know, in telling the story about Gary, Judd, is that, you know, it was very honest. No real filters, which kind of reflected who Gary was. And you did it in such a way that I think anyone in the spotlight would be very, very happy the way the story was told. You know, I think Gary would be very happy with it.
Well, he was always on a search for truth. That's what his work was about. That's what his spirituality was about. So I just thought, you know, he would want a warts and all treatment of his life. He would want us to look at his life as a lesson. Because as he got older, more of his focus was on seeing the ridiculousness of living by the demands of your ego. Yeah, so he was trying to figure out how to be a mentor, how to give more to other people, how to connect more with other people. And even though it's not that he got all the way there, he didn't. But it was his goal, and it's what was the focus of his journals. That's what he was writing about for decades. How can I let go of all of my attachments? How can I just be present and be a loving person?
Well, you tell such a great story about his family life and so forth. But, I mean, really poignant and something, again, I learned from the story is, you know, Gary had a brother, and his brother was ill, and he passed. He passed away at a very young age. I think Gary may have been 10 years old. And you know, they really, like a lot of families back then, didn't talk about those type of things. Some of those conversations were swept under the rug, and he never really, really had any closure or any real deep conversations about what happened as a young kid and with his family.
I think, you know, a lot of families were like that back then. It was 1960 when his brother died of cystic fibrosis. And how the family handled it is they didn't really talk about it very much. You know, one cousin said that he was over the house an enormous amount of time, and he never heard his brother's name mentioned again. And that's a lot for a little kid to carry. He didn't really have a way to work out his grief. Some of that led to his mom doting over him and engulfing him because he was a surviving child, which led him to maybe being a little more isolated. He got into ham radio, so he would he'd sit and talk to people from around the world on his ham radio. And he said that from an early age, that taught him about how everyone is connected, all around the world. And he was fascinated by that. And he also developed an interest in comedy, and that became his escape pod.
Well, and you talk about the connectivity that he felt on the ham radio, but he also learned that everyone's got their stuff. You know, everyone's got their issues, too. And he connected in that way as well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he became sensitive and empathetic to everybody's problems. Everybody has their struggle. In fact, there was something written in one of his journals in the years before he died where he said, you know, your job is... you know, to help people through this, you know, difficult life. That's your gift.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you know, you met him when you were 16, but then years later, you know, you developed a long time, you know, really wonderful personal friendship with Gary, but you also worked for him professionally. You know, as you mentioned, you know, he was hosting the Grammys and you wrote 100 jokes for him where he scribbled out and changed a bunch of the punchlines and everything. But you wrote, you know, I think from the second season of The Larry Sanders Show, I mean, your name was all over that show as a writer and producer. But you really got to know him, you know, personally, behind the scenes.
I did. I met him when I was in my early 20s. And at the time, he was dating this woman named Linda Doucette, who was later one of the stars of The Larry Sanders Show. And I always felt like I was like a starter child for them. Like I was an experiment in parenting to see how they liked it.
Yeah, Judd's coming for dinner. He's coming for dinner.
That's right. They were really, really nice to me in ways I truly didn't understand at the time. They had a lot of affection for me, and I was always so blown away that I was allowed into their world at all. I even went on to buy Gary Shandling's house when he moved out.
Oh, really?
And and I just lived there. So I was definitely living a Gary Shandling life in his footsteps.
Was that the house he never finished? Time. Was that the house he never finished, or was that the new house then?
It was the house before that. You know, he built a house.
Yeah.
And the joke was that he, you know, designed it with architects and then hated the result and lived there and complained for the next 20 years. He would just take you on a tour of why none of the rooms worked.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. But it's not only from your point of view, and you can see the passion just in your face talking to so many of the people that were close to him and so many people that worked with him. And again, you know, his Linda, you talked to Linda, you talked to Gary's cousin. I mean, you really touched so many elements of this. And the clips that you were able to get, a lot of this was his memorabilia, wasn't it? I mean, he's had this big trunk full of stuff. That you had a little access to.
Yeah, he saved everything, but he just chucked them in boxes and threw them in closets and storage spaces. So it's funny because he wasn't a very nostalgic person. There was never a photo of his brother in his house.
Yeah.
There was, you know, he wasn't one to have a lot of props and things from his different project laying around. All of his awards were in this tiny trophy case that was next to the washer and dryer in his laundry room. but he did save everything. It was all there. And he was considering putting out a book based on his journals and doing some sort of documentary based on his journals. So I took that as a sort of permission that he felt like there were lessons to be learned in his writings.
And great clips, too. I mean, great clips all the way along his career. I actually think, if forgive me if I'm wrong, but did I see Vic Tayback introducing him at a variety show of some sort?
Yes, Tayback introduced him on a show called Norm Crosby's Comedy.
Oh, yeah, Stop, I remember that, yeah.
Which oddly was one of the first shows that showed comedians from this new comedy club scene. There's all sorts of interesting interviews. In one interview, he's being interviewed by Alan King, who had a comedy interview show. We found so many great moments. I took a year just looking for footage.
Sure.
I just looked for everything that he had ever done. And there's all sorts of great things, like old Make Me Laugh episodes.
Yeah, stuff I saw like that. I saw that as well. And as I'm looking through and watching this documentary, you know, obviously two groundbreaking shows on television he was behind as well, besides being a successful stand-up and really his dream of being on The Tonight Show and hosting The Tonight Show. Larry Sanders took him to a whole new level. I mean, I thought he was cool before. This was a super cool show, one of the best written shows, which I know you are a big part of. But that, you know, that I think plays a big role in how his comedy developed, how he developed as an actor. I mean, this show was phenomenal, and he kind of enjoyed playing that role. Like I know he was offered, or they talked about him replacing Letterman when he went to CBS, and you talked about, you know, he never wanted to figure out or how to top himself every single night, but this show kind of gave him that opportunity to kind of be that talk show host, invite great friends and amazing guests on that show, and tell the story of what the egos in Hollywood were really like.
Yeah, he kept getting offered all of the 12:30 slots, and he was very much in contention for Johnny Carson's slot until he took himself out of contention because he was just too tired from doing his Gary Shandling show to also host The Tonight Show a number of weeks a year. But he said he was more interested in the people who make those shows and exploring their lives than he was in interviewing people and asking them what they were up to. He also was very daunted by the idea of taking a job that was very difficult and time-consuming that had no end date. The idea that if you took one of these talk shows, in a way you were committing to that being your creative life almost to the end of your life. That troubled him because I think he just thought, I don't have the energy to do that. And I think he had an instinct that in order to do it, you would have to be insanely creative, you know, to follow in Letterman's footsteps, someone who had innovated those shows and was so hilarious. You'd have to take it to the next level. And I think that he didn't have enough energy or interest in doing that or belief that he could do it. And then Conan came in and he did exactly that.
Yeah, he did.
He was so creative and imaginative, that he elevated it once more.
I would have been surprised before I watched the documentary that, you know, even with all that success around Larry Sanders, that he still was searching for happiness and really perfection in the show when it was really already that good, that he kind of still struggled with that, you know, all of his life.
Well, you know, the work is always so hard. It doesn't make much sense the way that production was set up. It was difficult because the writers kept changing. You never knew which celebrities would guest star on the show, which meant that it was hard to lock scripts because you just didn't know who would accept the offers mm-hmm. to appear. You'd ask somebody, to do it, and then you'd get someone else, and then you have to rewrite the whole script because they were a different person.
Yeah.
And they were shooting 17 pages a day, which was too many pages. You're supposed to shoot like 5 or 6 a day. And at the same time, Gary's expected to rewrite next week's script. And it was just too much. No one has ever had to work as hard as Gary did on a show.
I bet. Well, I tell you, when I watched this, I laughed out loud at stuff I haven't seen for years. I got tears in my eyes on the way the story was told and how it flowed and how you transitioned through, you know, the diary and so forth. I mean, it was just so well done. And I have to ask you, did pulling this all together, Judd, help you in your own grief with the loss of such a great friend?
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's allowed me to spend another 2 years with Gary, two very intimate years, and a lot of time in his head. You know, when you're reading so much journals, you're really along for the ride during their life.
Yeah,
it's very intense. So it'll be interesting to see what my grieving is like now that it's over. But you know, we're putting a book together, so I can delay grieving another year. I'm going to keep delaying grief as long as possible.
Well, I look forward to the book as well. And the debut of the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling debuts tomorrow, Monday, March 26th on HBO. And for more on the show and where to watch it streaming afterwards, visit HBO.com. Judd, thank you. And really, congratulations on this exemplary documentary. So well done.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay, Hank, I'm sorry.
In fact, why don't you just laugh in my face? I mean, you might as well do it now. You and Artie do it every time I turn my back.
Mother was ill.
What about the time I chipped my tooth on the bathroom urinal? Huh? What the f*** is so comical about that?
It was a back tooth, Hank. How you did it.
How appropriate that it's Fire Prevention Week and you guys are here.
There we go. You know what you got to know about fires? You got to close your doors in your house. I saw this thing. If you don't close the doors, you will die of smoke inhalation. Close your doors when you go to bed. I close them. My wife opens them.
She does not want
the doors closed.
She does not want safety.
Are we going to play that as a coincidence that it's Fire Prevention Week? Or are you going to act like this was your master plan?
This was the master plan all the way around.
Well done.
Chicago Prevention Week because the Chicago Fire, of course, took place here.
There you go.
This is O'Leary's
Cow. That's it.
Yeah, wouldn't it be weird if the Chicago Fire took place in Seattle?
It would be a little bizarre.
You know, it's crazy. You don't know about, people don't know about the Iroquois Theater fire here, which was like 18-something. And like 300 people died in the Chicago Fire, which is tragic. But like 800 women and children died.
This
is not funny stuff because but it was dark. And there was corruption involved, and it was in Chicago, and people didn't go to jail. Just like America these days, nobody goes to jail for anything.
Goes to jail.
You can investigate, you can do whatever you want, you could be on the Hill, you can look after these mutts, and they don't go to jail.
You know, they say that the Marshall Fields of Macy's on State Street, the 8th floor, is haunted from people, because they used it as a morgue for the Iroquois Theater fire.
Oh, man.
As we're getting into Halloween.
Read about that. It's tragic, heartbreaking.
It's terrible.
Oh, my God,
terrible.
And I'm not being funny.
No.
All right, Plyer.
Here's what I'm concerned about. So, no, you know, you were quoted as saying that you were going to kind of be, kind of off your rocker. You're just going to be unhinged and all that good stuff. And
well, here, we're here. We go. You're going to finish?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I talk faster. I'm his name with Papa Stolte, and he's got the scowl already. Because everybody has that quiet, still voice inside of it. I get in touch with it. I try to meditate. I don't succeed. And that tells you good things to do, bad things to do, and not things to do. But whenever I get with Chris, I really, really try when we're working together for long hours. I try to like squash that voice just to like let him stare at me, because I don't make sense a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And he called me an idiot the other day.
I was just going to say.
Do you remember when you called me an idiot the other day? He goes, you're an idiot!
He's got such a masochistic streak to him.
God,
no
I love beatings.
No one enjoys being called an idiot more than him.
Yeah.
And usually I'll say it in a friendly and casual way, but I may have barked it at him.
Oh,
the
other day it was great. I mean, other people were like, he just screamed idiot at you. I says, but it's with love.
It is with love. It is. But Chris and I, we went through the words you can't say.
You can, man. What a list.
And you went into the kitchen and said them all about 40 times.
I did. There you go. Can I say Glockenspiel?
You could say that.
All right, good.
Yeah,
well, you know, sometimes on our show, a scene will end and it requires a button. You can write a scene and you don't know that when you go to shoot it, it's going to have the ending will be a little empty and somebody would naturally say something here. So we find ourselves improvising the ending of scenes sometimes. Sometimes they'll use the improvisation. Sometimes they won't. But
I'm biting my lip so bad.
Whenever David is just off script, we all just kind of stand and look and just kind of shake our heads. That's not going on TV. That will not be on TV. What else you got?
That's not going on TV.
That's why I've got the Sharpie right by the dump button,
I never made it.
Chris, you're going to get intimate with that dump button.
You talked on your Facebook page about doing this, and you said you're not going to listen to any comments about having a face for radio.
Correct.
So one of your buddies, Joe, says you have an ass for radio.
Which is true.
What does that mean exactly?
That's Joe Faust, everybody. Thanks, Joe.
That's funny. And then another friend of yours says, I'd like to request this album be played in its entirety. It's the Welsh Band's 111-track Monster album, which is the world's longest.
And it runs just over 4 hours, which is the only reason we're not doing that.
That's true.
It's an album? How big is the record player that thing?
I don't know if it's about the size of the record player.
Yeah,
from the
I wonder.
Box set.
If it's multiple records.
Discs.
Come on.
Yeah.
You know what I wrote tonight on Twitter? I wrote like, hey, so dial in to 7:20 a.m. and I realized there is a whole four generations that have no idea what dialing in means.
Right. Yeah, right.
It's lost.
That's right.
I signified at work the other day of slamming down a telephone to our young colleague Daniel.
Right.
You can say his last name. I don't know how.
Daniel Kyrie.
Kyrie. Yeah. And I signified, and he looked at me like, "What?" And I went, "You have no idea what a slamming a phone is."
Yeah. No.
They don't know what they can throw an iPhone or something.
But you know, you can text. You can text and slam a text to somebody.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's nothing like slamming the phone down.
We
I won't say the things that would go with that, but you bang!
Well, we keep some of the vestigial terminology.
Okay.
We still say roll down the window. And no one's rolling down
that's
the window.
True.
In the
they
car.
Still
that's
say roll cameras. Yeah. There's nothing but digital inside
that's
that thing.
True. That's true.
There's nothing in there anymore but just some micro, what do they call processors?
Yeah, that's right. That's
there
right.
There we go. See, I knew that. You can't call me an idiot tonight.
Was ones
you call
and
me.
Zeros.
There's going
to
be coffee flying in
You're
here. I'm coming over
the
counter.
Zeros right now.
There we go.
Some guy named Chris asked if you're still driving the Harley he sold you.
I am.
Oh, look at that.
I am. It's a Fat Boy 100th Anniversary Edition 2003 Black.
Look at that.
There you go. You have an ass for a Harley.
Classic Fat Boy Harley.
I can't stand motorcycles. Do you know I got a thing? Oh, man. They drive me nuts, man. All these guys. Everybody's like everybody's a bandit now. Everybody on the highway. If they were all criminals at some point in their life, I don't know really where to go with this, but there are not that many criminals out there.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to be a macho criminal now with the bandanas.
With the bikes.
Do you wear a bandana?
Not everybody rides a bike as
a
bandit.
No, I wear a bow tie and suspenders when I ride my
bike.
There you
go. There goes Pee-wee.
There you go.
Did you think bringing up motorcycles, for example, would inspire this ire in Dave?
No.
What else?
No.
What else we got? Hey, you know, you ever notice butterflies?
I hate butterflies. They're flying.
Yeah, flying a straight line. I remember that that's a classic old riddle. How can you tell when a butterfly farts? Because he flies straight for a second.
That's a really good grandpa joke.
I like that one.
He is a grandpa.
I am a grandpa.
Are you a grandpa?
He's a grandpa.
He's a few years older than me. Are you really? Holy smokes.
I'll be 56 next week, and I have two beautiful, beautiful grandkids.
Look at you.
Tell your wife what you can't say anymore, what I'm going to say next year.
Yeah, my wife is by now burned out on hearing me explain all of my irrational behavior with, that's life on the double nickel, baby.
Yeah, you don't get to say that anymore.
I have to retire that next week.
You have to get rid of it. Yeah, yeah. So are the grandkids actually here in Chicago?
They're in Evanston, which is 5 minutes from us.
Because David was born in Naperville, but you've been here for like 30 years.
Coming up on 30 years.
Right? Yeah. And when, like, what was your big, like, what would you consider your big first role was? Like, that to you, like, not what critics will say or whatever, like, what to you felt like, wow, this, I made it?
Ah, boy, if you ask most actors that, they will have to say there were probably 15 times I thought I made it, and I was wrong.
Mm, okay.
I remember one of the sort of breakthrough experiences for me was understudying Gary Sinise in Steppenwolf's production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Ooh, that's cool.
I got to go on for him 9 times. I had played that role in college, and yeah, that was a big deal, but I couldn't, in theater, you can't be focused on the big deal in the moment.
Right.
I had some big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
And at a theater on a scale like Steppenwolf, you're pretty well taken care of.
Of course, yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
You step off stage to transition to the next scene and 7 people pile on you and change you out of this clothes and these clothes. You know, it's not like storefront theater, which I've logged a lot of years in as well.
I think Prison Break. I remember you doing Prison Break, Public Enemies, Boss, which is still one of my favorite shows. Yeah. I'm so bummed that never ended.
It had a real edge to it.
Heartbreaking. Yeah. You're talking about grandkids. You're talking about all this. When are we going to start talking about all the girls that we're dreaming about that we just can't do anything with anymore because we're just too old? Married too long. Yeah. We're going to talk about careers.
All the girls, basically.
Huh? I tried to trash my career so many times and succeeded. Let's talk about trashing
it.
Saying things that we shouldn't have said.
Don't quit now.
I told this guy that should have been like, he should have been castrated before he met me because I don't even know where to go with that anymore. Maybe I castrated him with what I said. I said to this guy one time,
"Married guy,
I love my wife dearly, but she puts up with anything. She don't care. Women grab me, I put my hands on them. She don't care. She knows when we get home at the end of the night that I am hers.
When you're a star, they let
you
do
it.
Is that right?
I'm one of those guys quoting our president.
Yes, you are. I thought so. I thought that's what you were doing. Yeah, yeah.
Nah.
What about you? Like, what would you say? Big first, like big deal role for you?
Your
big deal.
I'm going to tell you, dude.
Homicide: Life in the Street. I remember you doing one of those.
That's funny because that was the first decent job I ever got, and I loved it. I realized I love television, and there was a really cool thing that happened in that. When you learn to do TV, you got to throw looks because they need cutaways and stuff. And then one of these actors, lovely actors on that show. I'm not speaking disparaging about it. I don't remember who it was, but the camera guy was like, "Could you throw me a look? Because I got to get to the building." And he was like, "I'm not throwing anything." And he looked at me, and I went, "I'll throw it for you." And I threw him the look because you turn your head and you throw it so that they swivel the camera around. And I went, "This is a community thing." And that's what I love about my work probably more than anything, because I'm not really a good actor.
No.
Chris knows that.
Right.
And but I love the community, the people. It's the carnival. We're all a bunch of old carnies, and being with each other, laughing and carrying on.
Sure.
The work is secondary for me. I don't really, whatever show I'm on, I was on Golden Girls. Chris loves talking about
he was,
that.
No. He played Stosh on Golden Girls.
Stosh?
For 7 years.
Stosh.
We have a running joke because
he thinks it's Sex in the City.
I never watched
Sex in the City, whatever the F that show was. Oh, see, I
thank you. F is fine.
We're going to get back to that in a second.
All right,
which I never watched, and therefore I pretend to be only vaguely aware of what his career was.
Because burnt when the ladies go, "Oh my God, it's Steve!"
You play, you,
instead of like, police number three on the L-tracks in Night of Nightmares.
You played Stefan on Designing Women, am I correct?
Yes, I did. Let me tell you, an M.O.
Wait a minute, season one. Here we go. Season one. Yeah. I don't even know if the show had been on the air yet, but TV Guide was out doing a story on us as we were at some incident or other. And, you know, our job is mostly downtime. And we were all sitting around just getting to know each other at that point. But there was sort of a competitive clowning vibe going on. And they came over. They talked to us. They talked to David about Sex and the City. And then when the reporter went away, David said... David, who did seven seasons of Sex and the City, looked to all of us and asked completely earnestly, is it Sex and the City or Sex in the City? Because he did not know.
Well, because it makes more sense to have sex in the city. Sex and the city? And what? And what? And what?
You're asking the wrong guy.
There you're making go. A good point. You're making a good but you really didn't know.
That show, the shoes and the clothes and all that.
But when you played Squeaky on Charlie's Angels.
Squeaky.
Ah, Cheryl Ladd.
She was my favorite.
What road is he going down right now?
Where are you going with
that? Drifted. He said her name and he drifted.
I bought a Cheryl Ladd album, I think, at that time. she made all of those guys.
She recorded?
She recorded. She was in this blue satin. I still remember the picture, this blue satin thing. Yeah.
David Soul from Starsky and Hutch had an album.
He did.
What was his hit song? Come on, buddy. Come on,
Don't give up on us, baby.
That's it.
Wow. Yeah. Very good, Roger.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Thank you.
Wow, that was quick. I mean, how many firefighter shows have there ever really been?
Oh, precious few.
Yeah, right?
There was
a slight resurgence now, but no. I mean, you could name literally 50 cop shows for every firefighter show you can
Absolutely. Yep. Did you, when you guys were growing up in the 70s, did you say, I want to be Randolph Mantooth?
Yes.
Ever?
Yeah.
No.
No. And the other guy's name again?
That guy was handsome, man.
Kevin Tye.
I know, that's the one I don't remember as much.
My sister used to walk her dog in Los Angeles with Randolph Mantooth.
Is that right?
And we went to the same acting school about 20 years apart.
Randolph Mantooth and her dog?
And her dog, yeah.
Hey, listen, everybody. During the commercial break, we wrestled David down and made him take his meds.
Yeah. They have not kicked in,
they
man.
They have not. I kicked him, but by one, no. I should be nice and even. There we go.
Rescue Me?
Right.
Rescue really Me. Loved that show. I loved that show.
Yeah. Third Watch.
I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
Now there's something called Station 19, which I haven't seen.
Never heard of it.
It's bizarro. I don't get it. Yeah. I mean, God bless them. I don't want to talk. I hope they do well, but it's just a weird show.
Texts that always come in, people who always ask when I'm interviewing someone from Chicago Fire, they just love the whole Molly's thing. Because it's so Chicago.
Yeah, that's the thing. Let me tell you, here's a little behind the scenes, vis-a-vis Molly's.
Yeah.
We all sort of collectively roll our eyes and shake our heads when we know it's going to be a day at Molly's. Because every scene at Molly's is actually three or four scenes crammed into one location. Which means usually if you're not in a scene, you don't have to be there. But when you're at Molly's,
you are a
background artist. You're a background artist for all the scenes that you're not
Gotcha. Yeah. And is that Lottie's? It used to be Lottie's, right?
That used to be Bucktown. Yeah, and that was like the beginning of the whole transgender thing. There was a lady, Lottie's, and she had the junk upstairs and the junk downstairs. Mm-hmm. She had a big old Adam's apple. She was like 6'4", they said, and you could get busy any way you wanted with her or him.
Look at that.
There you go.
Chris looks very stunned by
there
this
you go. That's the story down there. And there used to be coppers down in the basement and firefighters and aldermen, and they were all up to no good.
Just like they are today.
We forget about it.
What I found interesting is when I was over at CineSpace a few weeks ago, you guys had the entire Molly's like built there now.
So even
the exterior. I mean, it's amazing how it looks like just a Chicago bar.
Well, we don't use the exterior. I wish we did.
You don't?
But once in a while, they'll go to just...
they just shot there yesterday. Yeah, the day before.
This week, they had to do an exterior at Molly's watching Severide go into the bar. But we have also faked an entrance right around the corner from our studio as an exterior for Molly's. But once we're going to visit a place over and over and over again, it becomes more practical to build a replica of it on our stage.
It does make sense, Do you guys like being out in the street shooting, or do you guys like being inside? Like, what do you like?
If we're out on the street, we're shooting an incident most of the time, and those are the most time-consuming. As I've said, most of our time is spent waiting anyway.
Do you like inside or outside?
I'm getting to where I prefer. I'm getting to where I prefer
angry.
Inside.
Okay, okay.
He is an inside guy. I love the outside. Give me the ice. Give me the slippery shoes. I'm going.
There was some incident or something that you guys were filming in WGN TV. This was years ago. The morning news.
Yep.
We reported it as a real incident that was happening.
That was a plane that landed on the street. Was it on Martin Luther King or Indiana or somewhere down there?
Yeah. That's right. One of the jaggy pants who was working said, "Oh, it's just when they figured out that they were wrong because." They were stupid. God bless WGN. But they were stupid. And they thought it was a real. They went, "Oh, it's just some show that nobody watches." Well, guess what? My mom still watches.
Can someone call Jeff Todd? Jaggy Pants. That was Jeff Jaggy Pants.
Can someone call Todd and ask if Jaggy Pants is okay? I think that's
Jaggy
probably
Pants
fine.
Is good.
I'm sure we're just fine. The iconic duo of Bill Curtis and Walter Jacobson both started at WBBM in the 1960s, but it wasn't until 1973, 45 years ago, this year, when the two reporters were teamed up to become lead co-anchors. And for the next 9 years, their newscast became the number one rated news program in Chicago. Not only was WBBM's The 10 O'Clock News tops in the ratings locally, but it became the blueprint for newscasts across America. Bill currently is the voice of WGN Radio, the host of Through the Decades on the syndicated subchannel Decades, and as Curtis Productions is about to kick off a new season of American Creed on CNBC. And Walter's Perspective currently airs right here on WGN every Thursday on the Steve Cochran Show and every Sunday morning on my show, The Dave Plyer Show. And for the first time in many years, in studio together, Bill and Walter join us this morning. Good morning and Happy New Year, gentlemen.
Hi. Same to you, David.
Thank you, David.
So nice to have us here.
Oh, it's great to see you both together. You know, it's been 45 years since you two were paired together on one of the, if not the most successful local evening broadcast in television history.
Yeah.
That must feel pretty cool.
It does. I wish we could start it all over again.
It's something we wanted to do after we stopped to do it again. And we did that. You know, we came back to WBBM just to try it out for a couple of days.
You know, that night, that Friday night that you came back to fill in for Rob Johnson, I was a big dork, and I literally stayed home that night. I didn't even want to DVR it. I wanted to see it live, seeing you two behind the anchor desk again. That's how iconic you guys are.
Well, and it was fun. That had not changed. I mean, Walter and I slipped right in from the first word, just like we had been. But everything else had changed.
Yeah, I bet.
And so after the 2 years, I think you would go back to work then because you really enjoyed it. I'd probably go on.
I mean, nobody could even touch you guys. And even as a kid, I knew how big this broadcast was. And I know you both started working at BBM in the 1960s, but you both came from very different backgrounds. Bill, at 16, you began as an announcer on KIND in Independence, Kansas.
It's the classic story, 250 watts, a little town of 10,000 people. It's the only radio station in town and probably the best experience I've ever had.
And at such a young age, what drove you into broadcasting at 16 years old?
A deep voice.
A deep voice. So you had that legendary voice back then.
I knew it then. Now, that's something I didn't know about. You were aware of a deep voice back then.
Yeah, even then. And I thought, I think I can slip into this, and I would like to do it. And I think I did for about 3 years before going to college.
Maybe that's what had something to do with how we worked so well together.
That may be.
Because we were just so totally different.
Yeah, that's
I always
true.
Considered myself a very squeaky voice. And when people stop me on the street and say, "I remember you, and I remember your voice," I say, "No, you remember those stentorian tones that came from Bill Curtis." I didn't belong in the business.
Oh, no. No, not at all. But I mean, but again, so different backgrounds. And did you know that that voice was powerful enough for radio, or did someone say to you, "Bill, you know, you should really consider this"?
Well, both. But I kind of knew it. And what I will claim is that from that early, because this is a good lesson for young people, from that early time, I had a vision. And the vision was to stay in broadcasting, may have been television, radio, the variety of jobs that were there. But this was it. Now, I also felt through high school and some college that it wasn't serious enough. It came so easy that maybe I needed something else. So I went on to law school.
You did. You did. I was going to say, your degree in journalism, your law degree, and then you went to Topeka. And you were on the air for over 24 hours covering a tornado there.
It is considered in Topeka and Kansas my big break.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I guess it was because after that, and being the only television station in town, 70% of the television audience was watching us. And I happened to be the guy on the air. There was a great team, you know, local, beyond local, but really part of the community. And as a matter of fact, a year ago, why they held a sort of a memorial service and asked me to come back.
Oh, that's cool.
To say thanks. 700 people showed up.
Wow.
Everybody who had had that experience. But in 3 months, I had sent my tapes out, and John Madigan from WBBM-TV hired me right into the newsroom as a reporter.
How exciting was that for you?
Well, it was a big city.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was married, had a six-month-old. And so I had to get used to the city coming from.
Sure.
I mean, the capital of the state was 150,000. So Chicago was really something. But I was ready to learn. And, you know, you wrote. There was a structure that you slipped into. We were using film and. I had not worked that much with film and processing and editing and unions.
So a lot to learn right off the bat.
A lot, yep.
Yeah. Now, Walter, you were born here in Chicago, and your journey to the newsroom started as a bat boy for the Chicago Cubs, right?
Hardly got me into a newsroom, but that's what's remembered about me.
That is. That is.
Curtis in a tornado, Walter in the dugout.
In the dugout. I like that. I like that. And you went on to get your degree in political science, a master's in journalism. Pretty deadly combination for you, because, I mean, that set the pace.
I never really knew much or cared much about the techniques of television. I was kind of the reporter with a pencil and a pad and just focused on that. I'm still very weak in that regard. I don't know these latest developments. That was his expertise. So I was very interested in hearing you just say that, Bill, that you got into this at that television and radio level. I got into it on the wire services and the City News Bureau.
Yeah, the City News Bureau was your big break.
Right, and a couple of Chicago newspapers. I was just reporting.
Yeah.
I was not performing and didn't know much about performing. I would try to discourage the two guys who came in from New York to hire us or to put together a whole new show. I told them, you know, this isn't my bag. They kind of liked my combativeness.
Yeah.
They were smart enough. The history of two major players at CBS in New York sent to Chicago to dig the CBS local station, Channel 2, out of the depths. And somehow they got this idea to put together two very different guys and didn't expect it to work. It was a gamble because the CBS ratings were just so bad. Anything might make them better.
But you were reporting at the time. Were you doing perspectives before you were anchoring? Were you going on the air already, or were you more behind the scenes?
Oh, all behind the scenes.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I was on-camera reporter,
yeah,
but I was
yeah.
a city hall reporter. So
sure.
I stood in front of the mayor's office when he held a news conference, and when he finished, then I put on my kind of smart-ass attitude and said, you know, this is what he said, but here's what he really meant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is good for young people, too. He had mentors, Jack Mabley.
Jack Mabley,
yeah. Did you work for Royco? Were you a leg man for Royco, Mike Royco?
Yeah, what about him? I worked with him.
Yeah, with him.
I was on the Chicago's American. He was on the Daily News, but we were assigned to the same beat.
Yep.
At the Cook County office building.
And City News. So he was really in the news-gathering part, the core of journalism in the city.
And you, I mean, you had an investigative mind. That's what drove you.
Yeah.
I mean,
curious. Every reporter needs to be that. But it developed. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were together 9 years, and during that time, there was a growth into number one. It didn't come overnight.
Oh, it sure didn't.
You know, it was, a year and a half? I even counted 3 years, but I think it was probably
a year
and a
half. Let me correct you. I remember this for sure. It was 5 years, and CBS had finally said, we've had enough of these two guys. They're not making it. We're going to end it. For some reason, they lasted another 6, 8, or 8 months, and in that time, we just took off.
Wow.
It had quite a bit to do with what was going on in Chicago at the time,
yep.
too, the politics and the crime, those kinds of stories. But
what wooed you back to the station? Because you left for a little bit. You went to MAQ for a couple years, didn't you?
Now, here's where we get in trouble, because at 80, which I am now,
okay,
which makes him 76, I remember 4 years difference. He's always seemed to be the older one, and I'm the younger one. The secret is that I'm 4 years older than Bill. But in the memory factor at being this age really gets in the way of things. I'm having trouble sometimes remembering exactly what happened to us during that time. But I do know that we were trying very hard to be, as you said just a minute ago, more serious. We both came with the one thing very common between us is that we came with a vision about what news ought to be. Let's reveal something here. You were much less confident than I was, and I was not confident at all that it would work, because you saw me as a troublemaker, a big city guy who wouldn't keep his nose out of government and politics, whereas he was a rural.
Exactly.
Fair to call you rural?
Absolutely, yeah. From Kansas.
Everything was very just straight.
Except
black
the
and
establishment.
White.
And look at the time.
I must have driven you crazy.
Crazy.
when you would read a story and I was sitting next to you and I'd make some remark about it, I could just see him going, oh, my God, Walter, stop it.
No, I learned how to be a good husband, which is to listen but not
intrude. That's a smart move. I like that.
It turned out to be the perfect combination.
It absolutely
He was the
did.
Inside guy. I was the outside guy. I came from 3 years with CBS News as a correspondent, so I like to travel and be on the street all the time. And I would come in sort of like, honey, I'm home, in the evening, ready to do my thing. And Walter had been working at home. And working all day on a perspective.
Sure.
And you put those things together, and it was fresh. And our conversations were fresh. You do your thing, I did mine. So it turned out to be this genius chemistry.
Yeah.
When something works, everybody's a genius. So the general manager, Bob Wessler, Van Gordon Sauter, the news director, took it, and they deserve credit. And all of a sudden, we're hot.
You are hot.
They had trouble with me in the beginning because CBS had a very firm policy that anchors are not to be commentators.
The
wall was between them.
Yeah.
And I had gone over to...
Way beyond.
I was fired by Channel 2 for being too controversial, and I went to Channel 5. And then I came back when we came back together. That was in 1973.
Right.
But I would not come unless I were able to continue my commentary.
So I was going to ask that. So that's what wooed you back, is you got to have that creative control over your...
Well, I knew about his reputation. He was on his way to major CBS things, and I was very, interested in being with him. And I wanted to do what I wanted to do the best, which was the commentary, much better than reading the news as an anchor. And I said I just couldn't come. I couldn't leave Channel 5 in order to come back here to just be anchor. I said, you'd make a bad mistake. This is a very, very conservative in many ways town. This is an Irish Catholic town. Mm-hmm. All those anchors from John Drury on down. What are you going to do with this little Jewish kid who doesn't belong?
Yeah.
And you tell us now, you must have felt, this is a mistake.
Well,
you didn't come here thinking that we were going
to.
We were not going to be co-anchors.
Yeah.
I was going to do the commentary, and you were going to do the anchoring.
Yeah,
they decided I should do the anchoring, too, I don't know. Do you?
No, I don't.
But it was brilliant.
You were ready to turn around and go back to California.
Well, that would have been a big leap, but I thought about that. I really did. It was a little bait and switch is what it was.
Sure.
But they got over the problems with Walter's opinion by labeling it. This is an opinion.
Yeah.
And
telling people directly
that
this was this
and,
wasn't.
And then what was different is that he was able to anchor with me for the rest of the newscast. That was a breakthrough.
It was a breakthrough. Who preceded you
both?
I actually
left the anchor set and came back to the newsroom in time to do the commentary. Took off my jacket, at which time I had
more casual. Yes, you did.
And I did the commentary, and then went directly to a commercial. That's very interesting today. There's no line, no wall between commentary and news. And
that's true.
I think that's just terrible.
And that's a growing trend. We are going to talk about that. Who preceded you both on the 10 o'clock news? We were listening to some promos before we get started.
He was Bob McBride.
Okay.
But before that, you remember Fahey Flynn.
Oh, of course.
And they were grooming John Drury, who, in my estimation, was the world's best anchor man because he's tall. He was tall, dark, and handsome.
Right.
He had a great voice. Great presence
and
on the
likeable.
Air. Yeah.
So likeable.
But he was so fed up with the news director at Channel 2, he left and he went to WGN and stayed there until he then went on to Channel 7.
Right.
But beyond that, you remember P.J. Hoff?
Oh, yes.
But Fahey was an era, and he ruled the roost in Chicago.
Absolutely.
Alone.
He did.
Essentially.
He did. This is also a time that we have to remember there was a handful of channels, so no cablite, no cable, no satellite, no streaming. And more than half the city was sitting down at 10 o'clock and watching your newscast every single night.
That's another reason that we could be number one with a million people or 2 million sometimes.
Yeah.
And they would turn over, switch from other stations. Now, one of the most satisfying things I have are young people who have children of their own who come just sort of transfixed, and they say, "I grew up with you."
Right? Yeah, I did. I did.
And,
I
grew up with you, and it's very meaningful. I don't know how
when I'm stopped on the subway or the street by recognition, I say, you know, how can you recognize me? I don't look the same.
You do.
I said, you know, you must have been 5 years old in the living room when Mom and Dad were telling you to watch because they like watching us. And they all say, yeah, that's what happened.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me tell you, I was born in 67. So I was a kid watching the 10, because my parents watched the 10 o'clock news. I mean, that was out of my grandparents' house. That was in my other grandparents' house. And there was a time, and I've shared this personal story with you guys separately, but I was 11. Very interested in the broadcast world, and a friend of the family was a WBBM cameraman, Noel Ludwig was his name, and he said, "Do you want to come down to the station and watch the 10 o'clock news?" And I thought, oh my gosh, yeah, of course I'd love to go down there. So 11 years old, I think it was like 1978, which was really when you said you really took off, and got there about 8:30. And saw you guys kind of walking around, getting your stories together, talking to other people in the newsroom, getting everything ready. And then the cameras went on, and I was in awe watching you two because, I grew up watching you. And then afterwards got to shake both your hands and say hello, and then got some pictures at the anchor desk. I got to go see John Coughlin and go stand in front of the weather map and so forth. And then the coolest thing was I got to go sit very seriously in Walter's chair in his perspectives office and give that look.
Yes.
Like I was going to tell them a piece of my mind. And that was the coolest thing. And I still have those pictures. And that was one of the coolest experiences of my life. So, yeah, I'm another one from a generation, a younger generation, that grew up with the both of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I got my news.
Yeah. That's why we're here today.
That's why you're here today. Exactly.
And who knows what's next?
That's right. Was the popularity of the newscast ever distracting to you when you try to do your job, or have some peace in your personal lives? You said getting recognized on the street and so forth. Was that a little tough? Because, you were number one.
No.
No, to be honest, it was not tough. It was enjoyable. That's some of the fruits of that labor.
Sure.
And too many people who do what we did or do beg off that. Oh, no, I don't like that publicity. I want my privacy. Come on. That's just ridiculous. That's a signal of your success. If people want to stop and talk to you,
so true.
Do it.
So true.
Fahey would use sort of it as an excuse. Well, people come up and I change the story if I go on. I found that you could leverage it. A newspaper reporter was with a gaggle outside a home where there had been a homicide or something like that. Everybody wanted the interview with the person inside. I walked up, and because I had been on television, they recognized me, invited me in, left everybody else outside. He said, "We're done."
Well, that's the power.
That's it.
And that's the power of that show. It was an incredible experience. watching you guys on there. Did you actually, were you asked to run for mayor at some point against Mayor Daley, Walter?
Well, it depends on who you mean by asked. Dan Walker was governor at the time, yeah. And his right-hand man, Vic DeGrazia was his name, kind of had this idea that why don't we try that? And I why not? You know, and they made up some buttons that said Jake for mayor or whatever.
Is that right?
But it was not serious. We never got around to petitions or anything.
But that's how powerful your perspectives were.
Yeah.
They made an impact on the city
and
the state. And exposure. Yeah.
And why is that not being done now? That's a very important part of television news. And there's no station in town that's doing that.
Not really.
Especially in a town like this where people are really interested. Politics is the second biggest game in this town, for sure, after sports.
And what it has done, along with other things, is it's removed a kind of an artery that connected the newsroom with the people in the community, because suddenly Walter was talking about issues that affected them, and they felt he stood up for them. Without that,
so what's happened? Why in the years since we were doing this have the stations looked down on the idea of commentary? I think I was the last one, I think.
Well, sometimes commentary from a national perspective is forced on station groups. I mean, I'm sure you've read a lot about that. But, I mean, this station here obviously values those perspectives, because when I play it during my show, I kind of have to stop and stand at attention, because I know you've got something extremely important to say, and I still think that's how listeners view that as well.
But where does the pressure come on the station management to not have commentary?
I think a part of it's political correctness too, that they're afraid of the pushback they might get from listeners that don't agree.
And they're afraid of just the controversy.
Yeah, right.
Because you may turn off 50% and 50% like you, and you send advertisers perhaps, but you know.
But it's always that way. I mean,
yes, and there's a balance.
Yeah.
If you have, you listen to the perspective, then you go into the rest of the newscast that is right down the middle, everybody's happy.
Well, and the newsrooms across America continue to evolve. You can catch Bill on the Decades Channel. His new season of American Greed on CNBC debuts in January. And new series, Deadly Rich, this year as well. And Walter's perspectives can be heard every Thursday on the Steve Cochran Show and on the Dave Plyer Show every Sunday morning. Bill and Walter, what an honor it has been to spend some time with you both. You guys must enjoy seeing each other as well.
Oh, sure. I'm very happy to hear he got married. And
yes. Well, you know, he's doing the voiceover work here. He needed the money so that he could propose to Donna. You know,
well, a marriage that started in the newsroom at that time.
And congratulations to you as well. And thank you both. It's been an honor.
Thank you, David.
All right. Thank you. And we'll be right back after this on 720 WGN. Now that's a rock anthem. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So from one of the greatest rock bands in history comes a reminder to never give up hope. Journey songwriter and keyboardist Jonathan Cain takes us on an odyssey from center stage with Journey when all of America was listening to songs like Don't Stop Believin', Faithfully, and Open Arms. Through a wonderful retrospective of music that takes us right to the present, Jonathan reminds us of the melodies and lyrics that serve as milestones for our biggest dreams, and they call us to never stop believing. And joining us tonight to share that journey with Journey is Chicago's very own and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Jonathan Cain. Jonathan, welcome in, my friend.
Hey, thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Good to be with you.
I have to tell you, I was born in 1967 in Schiller Park. You graduated in 1968 from East Lydon in Franklin Park. You played piano at St. Maria Goretti. I played at St. Beatrice. We were just a stone's throw away from each other.
Is that so funny? Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I played organ. I think it was Wurlitzer or Organ. They had their St. Maria. Fond memories of that neighborhood.
I bet. Well, I'll tell you what. First, a belated congratulations on your induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Thank you. Yeah, it was worth the wait. You know, long awaited, but I knew it was coming. the Cubs had to win for us to get in.
I know. That was part of your speech, which I just absolutely loved.
But that's it. I mean, come on, let's break it.
Yeah?
Break the curse of the goat.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's exactly right. Well, and I also have to say congrats on this truly wonderful book. It's very relatable. You know, you're so much about perseverance, the ups and downs of life. You know, you talk about the dedications, the rejections. I think everybody can relate to this book in one way or another, regardless of what you did for a living.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to show that it takes hard work to make it, you know, and that I hope it inspires and encourages, you know, the creative people and the dreamers. You know, they've been told they can't do it and they're not good enough. And, you know, the takeaway is, you're not always who they say you are.
Sure, that's true.
You're uniquely unique, and pretty much anything's possible. If you can dream it, it'll happen. It can happen. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm proof. Yeah, I was thinking about Roger Daltrey in the steel mill, hearing Johnny Cash sing Burning Fire. You know, loves the burning fire. Ring of Fire, right?
Right.
And, you know, it's just crazy that inspired him to go forth and, you know, and then who he is today, you know. So, you know, we all start somewhere. The other part of it is that life happens no matter how successful, how, you know, much money you think you've made and you're set, you know, and you make your first million, then you go, how do I keep it? You know?
That's right. No,
so there's a lot of life lessons in the memoir.
Well, and you talk about you talk about the accordion, and you know that's kind of how you got started. And the piano as well. Who taught you all that? Like, did you go take lessons? How did that all come
out? My father. It was my father. You know, after the school fire, you know, he wanted to shift me and give me something new to think about, something new to strive for. You know, and it was like, you're going to be great on this. I know him. So he went. Took me to a music school, and they only had guitars, and the piano was out of the question, too much money to rent one. So the little accordion case, trainer accordion fit me, and I was like, I'll take this, Dad, you know, and off I went. And I learned all these Italian songs and ended up doing concerts in the deli downstairs for the Italians, you know.
That's fantastic.
And that's when I was like, I want to be a musician, Dad, you know, and he said, well, I'll help you with that, son. I think you're destined to be a musician. And, you know, when I came home from the fire, you know, in OLA, 1958, and survived that horrible fire.
Yeah, we're talking about Our Lady of the Angels, and it's the 60th anniversary this year. Yeah, yeah.
It's 60. Yeah, I'll probably be there. I'll probably be there at the services. I was there for the 50th, and I plan on going every 10 years, you know,
Did you remember, did you know Father Joseph Agnibeni? Do you remember him from back then?
Sure, I do. Sure do. Who doesn't remember him?
Yeah.
Unforgettable.
What a great guy.
Yeah, he was like an actor, you know, like just the coolest daddy-o, you know, play football with us and just, you know, and what a deal he had, you know, at the morgue, you know, that night with all those parents standing out waiting for identification. Oh,
yeah.
Heartbreaking. But, hey, you know, my father said, Let's move on.
Let's redirect. Yeah, let's get your mind off this.
And there's music for you, you know. And you know, the Bible says, out of pain, something new is born. And I believe that something new definitely was planted in me. And God truly made beauty out of ashes, you know.
Well, you know,
and there's nothing more beautiful than playing music, you know.
Well, and you experience, you know, obviously you're very spiritual, and we'll get into that. But you talk about that fire. There was no grief counseling or anything. You really needed to find something, and the piano was...
Yeah. And, you know, I went to went to Washington to lobby for music in schools, and I used, you know, that story as the reason why we need to keep music, you know, in schools. Because it is, you know, redemption for your brain and your heart, and also showed these senators that the kids in band are all A students.
Yeah.
No accident. Don't take music out of school. That's not a good thing.
No, absolutely
not. Keep that money there. You know, that's
Well, not many, yeah.
You know, you talk about your father so much throughout this book and just the advice he gave you and the tips and the encouragement that he gave you. And, you know, yeah. I don't want to jump ahead, but Don't Stop Believing is something when you were trying to make it. You know, those were some inspiring words that you wrote down and you really never forgot.
No, I use it sort of as a little prayer every night. You know, I get frustrated or I get depressed. I look at that. My dad said, you know, and I had it in this lyric book that I took with me everywhere, Spiral Notebook. And so when I landed the journey, it was probably 5 years old at that point. You know, I had written that many songs in my lifetime. And so it was a big old fat Spiral Notebook like you get to go to college.
Sure.
Wrote it in the back. And Steve Perry looked at me at rehearsal for the Escape album and said, "Do you have any more ideas?" And I said, "Let me go home and look in my lyric book." You know, and sure enough, there it was. Stare me in the face. I'm like, that is a journey song. What am I doing? You know, and I had just been working with Steve, so his voice was fresh in my head. I could hear it. And I said, I'm going to give him something he can soar, you know, somewhere in the night. You know?
Yeah, right.
And there it was, you know. I brought it in, and all of us contributed on that song. Every one of us, you know, helped write that song.
Well, and here's the thing with that, too. You know, you've always noted that throughout your book that you felt, you know, God kind of put you in the right place at the right time throughout
your entire
life. And you went to the Chicago Conservatory of Music at Roosevelt and after graduating on to the Babies. And then, you know, it was one of those moments where, you know, you talked about going to the premiere of American Graffiti and meeting a very unknown Ron Howard and Harrison Ford and George Lucas and Wolfman Jack.
Harrison Ford for dinner.
Wow.
Yeah, we struck up a conversation. We were talking about cars, muscle cars and cruising and, you know, and all this stuff. And, yeah, his young Harrison Ford. I don't know this guy from Adam. I don't know anybody in the room. But the thing was, like, I was always next to Grady. I always saw it, you know, like it was early, you know, I got to meet all these really great people, you know, like Isaac Hayes and Stevie Wonder and even in Chicago, I ran into the guys that did American Breed, you know, Denny Shapney, you know,
yeah.
Bill Trout and Jimmy Golden, they had Wooden Nickel Records and they were doing pretty well in Chicago with a little independent label. You know, just very successful. And I'm like, well, then, you know, going to L.A. and then having Wolfman Jack management
right.
be my management.
Right, like, right.
That's unheard of. And then I'm in the studio, the same studio, and Chaka Khan records Tell Me Something Good, you know. And Stevie comes in with his entourage and his clavinet, and I'm there.
I know, but again,
I'm watching greatness, you know.
Yeah,
I got to meet Wayne Newton when I was a kid. You know, it's like Wayne Newton was the guy, you know, back in the day. You know, everybody Duncan Shane, and there's my manager and Lou Rawls, and you know, so it was always this sort of. This is what greatness looks like, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what. Stick around. There's more with Jonathan Cain of Journey when we come back on 720 WGN.
Step. Can't do a little, cause he can't do enough. Once upon a summertime, just a dream from yesterday, a boy and his magic golden flute heard a boat from off the bay.
Come and play with me, Jimmy, come and play with me, and I will take you on a trip far across the sea.
Belonged to a cookie or witch who had in mind the flute to snitch.
From her broom broom in the skies, she watched her plans materialize. She waved her wand, the beautiful boat was gone. The skies grew dark, the sea grew rough, and the boat sailed on and on and on and on and on and on.
But Muffin Stuff was watching. kitchen too and knew exactly what to do. He saw the witch's bold attack, and as the boy was fighting back,
he called his rescue racer crew as often they'd rehearsed. And off to save the boy they flew.
But who would get there first?
But now the boy had washed ashore. Puff arrived to save the day, which made the witch so mad and sore. She shook her fist and screamed away. Hey, Char, Puff, and Staff, who's your friend when things get rough? Hey, Char, Puff, and Staff, can't do a little pleasure.
All right, welcome in, everybody. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're going to jump right in with a legend in children's television. Sid and Marty Krofft created memorable, magical Saturday morning live-action television shows, beginning with creating the costumes and the sets for the Banana Splits, creating and producing H&R Puff and Stuff, Land of the Lost, The Bugaloos, Far Out Space Nuts, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, not to mention countless variety shows, including Donnie and Marie. But their success extends far beyond. They've entertained millions, employed thousands, and inspired many of today's content creators. And they're still in production today with Mutton Stuff, which airs on Nickelodeon, and recently a revival of Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, which appears on Amazon. This last month, the Krofts were honored with the Television Academy's Lifetime Achievement Award, and joining us to celebrate over 50 years of partnership and countless childhood memories is Marty Krofft. Welcome in and congratulations, Marty.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
After hearing your introduction, I think I need some vitamins.
You guys have just never, ever, ever stopped working. And really, on behalf of all of us that love these classic shows, you know, thank you.
Well, hey, I'm glad you're the fan.
Absolutely.
That's why I called you on Sunday.
That's right. You know, puppetry, though, I was looking back at this. Puppetry is part of your family history, beginning with your father.
Right. Well, my dad, you know, he was actually not the puppeteer, but he managed my brother, who is a lot older than me. Not that much. Close to 10 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, he is in good shape, though. If you ask me where he is, you won't believe it. He's at the gym.
He's working out? Good for him.
Absolutely, every day.
That's great.
I go to work, and he goes to the gym. It's a great partnership.
What a yin and yang that is. I love that. Well, you and your brother are really a perfect balance in the relationship, in this partnership. You first collaborated together in 1958, when Sid was performing with Judy Garland. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, my brother was with his puppets. You know, we're puppeteers. That's how we started. He was the opening act for several stars, and that's when I joined him. I joined the act. You know, we were on tour with Judy Garland for about a year on and off. Sinatra, Liberace, Tony Martin, Sid Charisse. Gee, it was on and on. So, you know, we were always hired to be their opening act because it was always consistent for them, because the star always looks for somebody to warm up the audience.
Sure.
But they have a comedian, you never know what's going to happen. So it left them a big opening for us.
Yeah, and these shows, I mean, you know, again, you were mentioning all these names that you worked with and opened for, and included Sinatra, too, and Liberace, and the Andrews Sisters. The shows were really about marionettes for adults, and it's really nothing that had ever been done like that before. I mean, that was groundbreaking in itself.
Yeah, that's right. Just think about it, the Dirty Puppet Show.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly.
That was a quote I just stole from Time Magazine.
Is that right? Is that what they called it?
We were at the Seattle World's Fair, and the fair brought us up and built us a theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we were actually the hit of the fair as far as the shows go. And on opening day, Billy Graham had a rally, and they invited him to come see our show during the day. And somehow that night, he told 30,000 people, don't go see a show called Les Poupées de Paris because the women don't wear bras.
Oh, that's right.
Time Magazine picked up on it.
Whoa.
And clarified that they were not girls, they were puppets.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. And he actually came and saw the show, and he didn't realize those were marionettes, huh?
Well, no, he did, but forgot to tell his audience.
Ah, gotcha.
But the girls don't wear bras. It's the puppets that didn't wear bras.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, I mean, and you did this. I mean, you guys toured for years, really honing your craft. And I have heard you tell the story before. You were the opening act for Tony Martin. And one night you were in the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel, where you met Walt Disney, and he gave you some really great advice.
Right. He came over to the table, didn't know that he had been at the opening of Judy Garland in Vegas a year earlier, and because they had flown in all these stars, mm-hmm. first time she ever appeared. So he heard about our puppets, and so he said, whatever you do, don't sell anything you ever create, and always fight for your name above the title. And that'll be the hardest thing. And he wasn't kidding. So he told us those two things, but the most important thing he forgot to tell me. He never told me how to save my money. That's probably why I'm still working.
Well, you know,
I had a good time in the 90s
yeah.
and in the 2000s, and now I still have to work. But that's probably a godsend.
Yeah, right. I mean, right. If you keep working and loving what you do, you know, I mean, that's the secret, right, to longevity.
Well, yeah. You know, it isn't just Sid and Marty Krofft. You know, we have a company.
Sure.
We're probably the only independent left from the 70s and 80s that produced kid shows. You know, from Hanna-Barbera on and on, Filmation, they all went out of business, or they sold out, or they went bankrupt.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, you know, we're holding the flag. And oddly enough, there's only two companies left in L.A. That are, you know, that have libraries that never sold their company. And the one company is an elephant, and one is a flea. So you figure out the flea, and the elephant is Disney.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, you're totally right. But you know what? That advice he gave you and what you're talking about is being one of the only independents. So I knew as a kid, and I'm talking 6, 7 years old watching these shows, I knew when I saw Sid and Marty Krofft, it was going to be something crazy good and something that I've never seen like it on television. And your name was as synonymous with the show names themselves and the people that start in them because, right, you guys put your name and labeled it right in front of the show.
That's right. And that was not easy. So we do have, you know, we're very fortunate. We have a brand. I've got three daughters. My daughter, Deanna, she is the COO. She runs the place. She's also a great producer. Got two other daughters, Christina, who's an actress and a writer. And, of course, Kendra, the baby, can make us all look good.
That's good.
She's a makeup artist.
Oh, that's great. Right. That's great. That's great. But, you know, back then you started, you got a call from Joe Barbera of Hanna-Barbera, which is pretty cool, about a project called The Banana Splits. You know, they were giants in animation, but they never really did like this live action type thing before, and they needed your help. They knew of you.
Yeah.
Tell us about how that.
Well, not only did we help create that, and we built it all, and they probably, Joe Barbera, regretted that he ever called me because we changed the face of kids programming after that. But while we were building Banana Splits, the head of programming, Larry White from New York, NBC, and Kellogg's would come in and check the progress. So one day, Larry White asked me, well, why don't you create your own show? And so there we went. We had a character called Luther that we did shows for the Coca-Cola company at Six Flags. We had 1,000-seat theaters and also at a World's Fair in San Antonio called Hemisphere. So this character became like the hit of the fair. So we took that character and we developed a show around him, renamed him H.R. Puff and Stuff, and then the rest is history.
Where did the name come from, H.R. Puff and Stuff?
Well, you know, I actually just came up, you know, out of nowhere, a friend of mine came up with something like that, and we actually put that, he came up with Puff and Stuff, spelled it different, and, you know, we put the H.R. on it, which we say is Royal Highness backwards. Nobody believes it.
I like that.
You know, we once had a survey of 1,000 people. So 1,000 people said, 999 said hand rolled. And the right one person said, Royal Highness backwards. And it was Sid and myself that said it.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's cool. That's cool. And you cast Jack Wilde. You cast Billy Hayes as Witchy Pooh, who was one of my favorites. Puffin Stuff was voiced by Lenny Weinrib. And budgets at that time, you know, were about, and it sounds like a lot of money, but it's not, $55,000 plus an episode. But it was never enough to do what you really had to do to make it fabulous. Because those sets, I mean, were, you know, there were only 17 episodes, which I'm not sure people realize, but, you know, that's a lot of production work, you know, that went into all that.
Well, that was the problem. You know, you have to watch out what you wish for. We were wishing for our own show. There was no way we could do it for the fifth, it was actually 54,000 an episode. And we wound up spending about double that, and fortunately, when a big studio does that, they've got deep pockets coming from other places.
Sure.
But we did have income coming from other places, like the Six Flag Parks, that we had shows at every park. There were four of them. So we got ourselves in trouble, but it did cost close to $1 million an episode. And
wow,
most people, most kids, you know, that saw it, because of the amount of reruns, and there were like 100 of them of each episode, everybody thought we had. We didn't know. They thought we had a hell of a lot more than 17.
Yeah,
episodes.
Yeah, I did too.
Right.
Yeah, as a kid, I did too. You really didn't do it. Really rehearse, have rehearsals, because you filmed 5 days a week nonstop when you were doing these shows.
Yeah, we did. We filmed it. It was filmed, you know, like a film, and we filmed every day. So you wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have table reads and run-throughs. So fortunately, we hired the right people. You know, well, I had to go to London to find Jack Wilde. He had just been nominated for an Oscar for supporting actor in Oliver, that ultimately won 11 Academy Awards. And, of course, Witchy Pooh, which is Billy Hayes, she was a Broadway actress, and there's no witch better than her. So yeah, we had two pros. We had pros like Lenny Weinrib doing the voices. So we always hired the best people we could find. And most of the time, young people. Because young people don't know what can't be done. So they don't know too much, which is good, which was us also.
Right, right, right. I also know, and I'm just going to throw this in here, you guys produced a lot of variety stuff, and we'll get to that, but one of them was the Paul Lind Halloween special, which is the wildest show. I mean, the group Kiss was in it. Betty White was in it. It was this mishmash of interesting people that I would never have imagined putting on one show. And you had Billy Hayes as Witchy Pooh, but then you had Margaret Hamilton as the witch from The Wizard of Oz come. And
right,
that was crazy to see those two on stage together.
Well, we always loved Margaret Hamilton.
Yeah.
In fact, she told my brother one day, the best witch ever is Witchy Pooh.
Oh, that's
good. You know, that's let's great. Face it, she was the most famous witch.
Sure.
But Witchy Pooh, you can't beat Witchy Pooh.
No, no.
Billy Hayes was a home run.
And you were filming on the Paramount set next to Here's Lucy, I think, right, with Lucille Ball.
One thing that amazes me this morning, you know more than I do about what went on. You did your homework. You have the best memory going.
No, I do my homework when I'm talking to, especially when I'm talking to a legend, I'll tell you. But Lucy used to come over to your set and check things out because she thought it was fabulous, right?
Wow, you even have that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Lucy, that's where we, I think, first met her. I bonded with her big time. Ultimately, I bonded with her family. Mostly, you know, Lucy, the daughter, was a close friend of mine. And, you know, Lucille Ball was a trip. As a matter of fact, she used to always invite me over to her house while she was doing her makeup. So I would sit in her bathroom, and we would dialogue for an hour at a time.
That's great.
So this was, you know, that family was great. And, you know, we were real close to them. And, of course, if she hadn't been next door to us at Paramount, we would probably never had, that would have never happened.
That's very cool. That's very cool.
You know the sad part?
What's that?
I talk about this all the time. When we were with all these stars and all these people, whoever they were more than the ones we worked with, of course. You couldn't carry a camera around and take a picture because there was no cell phones. So I have very few pictures of being with these people.
I know. That's kind of a bummer. I know what you're saying. Right. You know, it was more about autographs back then. I mean, well, but this was your experience. I mean, being a producer and stuff and getting to meet and talk to all these people. Yeah, you would have to have had a photographer follow you around 24/7, right?
Well, listen, I got stories that no one believes. Are you kidding? I met at the Fontainebleau in Miami where we worked with Judy Garland, and Sinatra was coming in after us. He said, come on, follow me. I want you to meet somebody. He walked me down to the pool into a cabana, and who was in there was Jimmy Hoffa and his wife. Wow. So I bonded with Jimmy Hoffa and his wife.
Wow.
So I got to know them, and I got stories there that were incredible.
I bet.
But no pictures.
No pictures. I know. Oh, it's great to have the memory on all that. You know, you had great success with H.R. Puff and stuff, but then came the Bugaloos, where the music became the star of the show just as much as the show itself.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, we just did a pilot on the Bugaloos, a new one, but we're going to do it again. And not sure how we're going to do it, but... so far, I got Randy Jackson, who wants to do the music on it this time.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So, you know, we just keep going. I don't take no for an answer. You know, with Mutton Stuff, we have 73 episodes. We just finished 2 one-hour specials on Mutton Stuff. In fact, I had Randy Jackson in one and David Arquette in the other.
Oh, that's great.
And with that, that success, when we did the first pilot, I got a call from an executive at Nickelodeon on Thanksgiving Eve, so I thought the show was getting picked up, and she ran the show into the ground and didn't pick us up. So I went to New York. I talked to Seema Zarkami, who was the president, and I badgered her, and she gave me another pilot. And then, you know, she picked up this thing 7 times.
Wow.
Which is incredible in the last 2.5 years.
Well, and that got you back into kids programming after all these years. Well, we're talking to legendary TV producer Marty Croft, and there's more after the news next on 720 WGN.
Marshall, Will, and Holly on the routine expedition met the greatest earthquake ever known.
Splits, brought to you by Kellogg's. Kellogg's puts more in your morning.
More nourishment.
More flavor.
More fun.
It's the Banana Splits Adventure Hour, starring the Arabian Nights, Danger Island, the Three Musketeers, and the Banana Splits.
One banana, two banana, three banana, four bananas make a bunch, and so do many more. Over hill and highway, the banana bunch.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to legendary children's TV producer Marty Croft. Marty, the networks were after you to produce shows for all their networks. You had shows on ABC, NBC, and CBS. Lidsville came around with Butch Patrick, who was Eddie Munster, Charles Nelson Reilly, Billy Hayes. Sigmund and the Sea Monsters with Johnny Whitaker from Family Affair, Billy Barty, Mary Wicks, Margaret Hamilton.
Bob Denver.
Well, yeah, at Far Out Space Nuts with Chuck McCann, who just passed away. Yeah.
I don't know if you said Martha Ray, who was Benita Bizarre.
Yes.
If I go first. Yes. You know, and I mean, we always went after him. You know, Jim Neighbors was great. So, you know, we always had these people in our shows, those kind of names. They attract, the adults were important for that. Kids didn't know who they were. But the adults, you know, they lead the kids to the shows.
Yeah.
We were smart about it.
I think that was brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Because they were familiar faces in all this. Now, Land of the Lost was a little bit different. And anytime I hear the words Marshall, Will, and Holly, you know, I know that theme. That theme kicks in right away. That show was a show we always sat down and watched it. When I watch it now, those special effects were hysterical. I mean, just seeing the dinosaurs and stuff going on.
They weren't prehistoric, but they weren't what they are today.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, that's what the kids had. And, you know, I don't know. We find out the more money you spend on the show, you're going to have more trouble. You know,
that's true.
Everybody watching your shows, they're looking at the story and they're looking at the characters. And then that's really what keeps them on your, you know, on your show. Because today, there are 100 places you can switch off to.
That's true.
And you can watch them at any time.
Yeah.
You know, before it was getting up a Saturday morning with your cereal and watching the shows.
And then you got into variety shows, too. I mean, you know, first being Donnie and Marie.
Well, that was the big breakthrough for us.
Yeah.
That was Fred Silverman and Mike Eisner that were together at that time at ABC. And they called us up one day and they said, hey, we thought we saw two kids, you know, on a TV talk show. What do you think? We're thinking about doing that. And they said, look, you know, maybe we'll give this to you to do, even though we hadn't done it before. And they did. They put it on Friday night at 8 o'clock. ABC never had a Friday night, ever. So Donnie and Marie made their Friday night. So that was our first one in. So that opened us up for more of those kinds of shows. And we wound up with the Brady Bunch Hour. We wound up with... you know, Barbara Mandrell, the Mandrell sister.
Pink Lady and Jeff.
Pink Lady and Jeff. And we did Patti LaBelle that never got on as a series at NBC. So, as you know, most of our shows, I think, got on this way. We did about 20 pilots in the life of our career, and we got 18 on the air.
Wow.
And 17 worked. So our batting average is not bad.
No, it's not bad. It's not bad at all. And in all this, you know, and I read about this, and I want you to share this, because when I was growing up in the 70s, you know, Saturday mornings were also filled with McDonald's commercials. And I always watched the McDonaldland characters, and I thought to myself, boy, this is really, really, really like the characters and the costumes that Sid and Marty Krofft puts on their shows. And there's a story behind that.
Well, there is, because I went to my lawyers in L.A. and I said, you know what? I think we should really sue them, because they did really steal H.R. Puffin stuff, because the Hamburglar was Witchy Poo, Man McCheese was Puffin stuff. So they said, you're out of your mind. You're not going to do that. You're going to get killed. So 13 years later, we finally did beat them. And, you know, that was a big, big win for us. And it was not the money. It was just, you know, that we were able to do that. And so that was really where it's at.
But didn't they engage you, though? Didn't they engage your company in the very, very early stages about this? And then they went off and did it themselves, right?
I don't know. But I think at the time, I think that they were given, you know, I think that they didn't advertise on our shows for a while. But, you know, this thing happened. Ray Kroc called me, who was the founder.
Oh, yeah.
Took him to Six Flags, and he told me about this idea he had, and then they said they weren't going to do it. And the next thing I know, I came back from Europe, I saw it on TV. So that's how this whole thing happened.
Yeah.
They could have settled it with us immediately,
sure.
But they didn't want. And at that time, nobody ever, you know, when the trials today are all advertised, they got stories. So we were told not to talk about it, which is probably a mistake. But anyway, that was, you know, it's the leading copyright case in the world today. So Sid and Marty Krofft are known for their shows and also for this lawsuit decision.
Yeah.
Which is every college kid that goes to law school studies this case.
Well, here's the thing. No, you know, no one really sues McDonald's and wins. So good for you on that one. Years later, in the 80s, and I always found this to be fascinating, came prior. Go ahead.
By the way, just going back to McDonald's, you can see it didn't hurt them. This case.
No, it didn't bother them. No. Back in 84, you guys launched Pryor's Place. And for the reputation that Richard Pryor had, not to mention, of course, being a brilliant comedian, to headline a children's show was such a bold move. And the guests on that show, and I was pretty, you know, I was in high school by that point, but I found it so fascinating that he was doing a children's show. I was watching it. And I remember Sammy Davis being on there and Robin Williams and Lily Tomlin. And it won Emmys. It only lasted for 13 episodes. Why didn't it continue? I thought that was a really interesting show.
It was a miracle we could get that many with Richard.
Yeah.
You know, close to him. And he was, you know, he said he would do it. Then he said he didn't want to do it. He would do it. As a matter of fact, one day, we're already building $250,000 worth of sets. He came to the studio with his lawyer, who actually was our lawyer at one time when he was a kid. And he said, look, I don't want to do this show. I said, look, I got $250,000 in the sets. He said, that's okay. He says, you know, Skip has a check in his pocket. I'll write you a check for $250,000. I said, Richard, could you please take a walk with me? So then the next thing was he said he would do it. And the final story about this is, which was like real tough to do this, and every night I would talk to him and not about the show. He wanted to do a press conference. He was starting up a new black film company. And he asked me to organize the press conference. I said, Richard, I don't do this. He said, no, but I trust you. So I did it. I hired my two press agents to do it. And there was a woman from the New York Times there who asked him a question. And she said, why did you do this show, Richard? Because you're paying back the kids for all the havoc you caused? He says to her, no, do you know Marty Krofft? She says, no. Well, if you knew him, you would say yes immediately and get him the hell out of the room.
That's awesome. Oh, that's great.
Was the major talent of all time.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. And he was really a nice person. He was a great person. He just had a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Yeah. No.
Showed up. He was a pro. We did the 13 shows. And he said, Marty, sorry, I don't want to do anymore.
Yeah. 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 It was an interesting show. And of course, you guys just, you know, again, you keep rolling. Mutton Stuff, as you mentioned, on Nickelodeon. My 5-year-old loved that show. You rebooted Sigmund and the Sea Monsters on Amazon. And finally, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Television Academy. And I truly believe when I saw it, I was so happy for you guys because I really feel like it was a long time coming. But how wonderful is it that to be recognized for a lifetime of work?
Well, that was great. You know, we did good. When we found that we were getting it, of course, that's you work all your career. So that's your peers, you know, you're giving you that award. And the night we got it, it was great. You know, these award shows are brutal. So we were the home run of the award show because, you know, we showed a great clip of our careers.
Sure.
And then my brother went out for an hour and a half and told him how he felt. And then I did 2 minutes. And that was it. I'm only kidding about my brother. But anyway, I think we were entertaining. And you know, and it's a great thing. And so now we have an Emmy.
You know,
our shows have had Emmys, and we've been nominated before, but not us. So this is really the first award for Sid Marty Krofft.
I'm so happy for you. I mean, congratulations on all that. Let me tell you, all I did was post an image of Puff and Stuff on Facebook to say that you were going to be joining our show this weekend. And of course, 8 billion people reacted that this was the best show ever. And I mean, it's just great when you think about that show is almost, you know, 50 years old and it still invokes that type of excitement and that type of memories by people that grew up with all your programming.
Well, I could have a mission for you.
Mm-hmm.
We're told that we have about 40 million fans. So if you could figure out a way to get a hold of them and get them each to send $1 a piece, we could all go to the south of France and never come back.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to work on that for you. I'm going to work on that for you. Well, I'll tell you what. Many of the Krofft productions, of course, are available on DVD. Their website is sidandmartycrofft.com. You can catch their latest creations, Mutton Stuff on Nickelodeon and a reboot of Sigmund and the Sea Monsters on Amazon. And again, Marty, congratulations on the Lifetime Achievement Award and all your success. And thank you for the joy you have and continue to give us for many years to come.
Hey, thanks so much, David. And you really impressed me. I've never talked to anybody that knew as much as you, including Sid myself.
That's great. That's great. Well, again, an honor speaking with you. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right. It's 720 WGN.
The bug are loose, we're in the air and everywhere, flying high, flying loose, flying free as the summer breeze.
Steve Dahl with you.
And Gary Meyer.
And man, we're in trouble again. Look at this.
Les Tracy with Rock and Roll on FM 98. You really
got me down. Mitch Michaels doing the cruise on the loop.
Chicago Rock!
Sky Daniels into the 80s at FM 98. You have a remarkable mouth.
We have a remarkable radio station.
The Loop, where Chicago rocks at FM 98.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So it's official. Just a couple hours ago, the Loop 97.9 is no more. As the station was sold to Christian Broadcaster Educational Media Foundation for $21.5 million, which began airing their K-Love Christian format. Now, thousands are lamenting over the sale on social media about the end of an era, but throughout the week, many have said at the very end, the Loop really wasn't what the Loop we grew up with. It's a shell of its former self, and we're really celebrating the Loop of the past. In the earliest days, we listened from morning till night to Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer, Kevin Matthews, Jonathan Brandmeier, with rock jocks Mitch Michaels, Sky Daniels, Bob Stroud, Bobby Scafish, Patty Hayes, and Wendy Snyder, and the likes of Matt Bisbee, Robin Baumgarten, Dorothy Humphrey, Leslie Kiling, Jimmy DeCastro, and Larry Wharton. Later added Bill Leff and Wendy with their own weeknight talk show. Danny Bonaducci, Pete McMurray, Steve Cochran, and so many others, which included sister station AM 1000. And the lineups were nothing less than legendary. And joining me this morning to talk about the legacy of the Loop are legends themselves. It's Kevin Matthews, Wendy Snyder, Bill Leff, and broadcast executive and all of our bosses, Larry Wharton. Welcome in, everybody.
Hi, Dave.
What's happening?
Hi, Dave.
Dave.
Hi, legends. Hi, other Loop legends. I shouldn't say other, and it implies that I'm one of them, but I'm glad to be with you guys for the moment.
Kev, you there, buddy?
I'm there, and Larry, you are. You're in this. And Larry, I got to ask you a question. I think you could have negotiated a better deal than $21 million. That's high.
Kev, $21.5 million, I believe. But you know what the irony is, from a business standpoint, do you know what the value of the Loop was when it was peaked? Well, we were all there. Like everyone on this call, fans, Dave Plyer was there when it was of the value I'm about to tell you.
75, 125, what was it?
It was 200.
Oh,
$200 million. Wow. And it was based on, that's just based on, and some of you business folks out there know, it was based on what we were earning times the multiple of the value of a radio station at the time.
Wow!
So it was it peaked around 200, and then I don't mean to just roll here, but just because it's related, the company decided to change the format one other time. And Kev will remember this, maybe Wendy and Bill too, but they wanted to make it best music on the planet.
Oh yeah!
Some genius consultant, best music on the planet. I tried to fight it, and I got sent to Detroit.
I remember that.
Oh man!
Yeah, right. And it's Michael Corleone chapter, you know, the kids in Detroit. Don't start the car. And then it didn't work. So guess what? They sold it to another Christian, if you will, based company. It was Bonneville for $75 million, I believe.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a little history.
Yeah.
The value of this.
But I feel like everybody's like in this mourning, so we're doing it all on social media. But I don't think we're mourning the Loop of today. We're mourning the Loop of yesteryear in all of this. I mean, nobody's really, it's not about now, and with all due respect, not about ManCow. It's about those days in the 80s and 90s that we're all talking about, right, Bill?
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Loop has not been the Loop for several years. The Loop that I'm upset about losing is my very first job and the camaraderie. We all hung out. I mean, Matt Bisbee was doing promos that said, if you're not cranking it, you must be yanking it. Do you remember that,
oh, yeah,
guys?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very edgy stuff. Kev, what about you? I mean, seriously, people are talking about the good old days, right?
Well, my saddest day is when AM 1000 flipped to ESPN.
Yeah.
So that was... to me, that's the when it imploded. I was briefly on overnights on the FM, and then they bought the AM and moved everything over there, and that's my fondest memories.
Yeah. Larry, I know you're just joining us for a little bit today, but when you think of the Loop, and I'm talking about, again, those golden years, you know, it was a special time. I mean, you have to look back and say that was one unique time in radio that we'll probably never relive again, right?
I think so. I think the whole industry and consumer marketplace has changed measurably. So that's a big part of it. But I think the assembly of people on and off the air then was just amazing. And Wendy just said one of the MVPs that was not probably a silent MVP that we all know was possibly the most valuable person. And that's Matt Bisbee, the voice of the Loop. And, you know, amazing contribution by a guy that's not a household name, right? But we all know that.
Sure. And then, of course, Jimmy DeCastro, because he pulled it all together, didn't he?
Hey, now.
Hey, I know I wouldn't have been there if it weren't for Jimmy. I mean, I met Jimmy in the 80s, and I was his customer. And he was my customer, actually. And then one thing led to another, and he gave me that great opportunity. So I owe Jimmy all of it.
But Larry, you and Jimmy and Matt had this philosophy. You had this way of doing business that I don't think anybody in radio has ever done before or after. Do you know what I mean by that, right?
I think I do. And, you know, quite frankly, and I came from ABC television at the time, and I was in a much more structured company and environment. And it was Jimmy who taught me that we could do it our way, right? He called it high school with money, but then he behaved that way.
Yeah.
But it delivered, too. That's the thing. You said it was worth, what, $200 million back then? I mean, come on. It was working.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was working. And you know, we talked about, reflecting and talking about the creativity that, you know, was on and off the air. And it seemed so natural at the time, the creativity. Now it seems so manufactured, if at all.
But you guys let them do. You really let all the hosts do whatever they wanted. I mean, you really did. It was pretty much an open forum. So how did you deal with those moments, whether it was with the FCC or complaints and stuff? I mean, was it you knew what they were all about. You knew what their personalities was. You knew what they were going to deliver, and you knew it was delivering ratings. So how do you balance trying to manage this group and you know, maybe try not to get fined on and off every single week with letting them do what they wanted to do and keep the ratings where they were?
Hey, look, it was a tightrope act. It really was. And as we got bigger, the stakes got higher. You know, when I got there in the late 80s, half of our revenue came from Budweiser.
Oh, wow.
And Kev knows that to be true because Kev and some of the other talent had personal service contracts with Budweiser. And we had to start doing business with other beers. We were getting so big. So that was an interesting internal moment and change. And yeah, the FCC was going through a lot of defining of what's indecent and obscene. We were part of that. And we were the company because of our owner, Scott Ginsburg, who told the FCC, your rules here, your statutes are so vague that we don't know how to abide by them. You know, they say that which is a patently offensive as deemed by community standard. We said, whose community?
Right.
Because not in ours. And our company stood up and didn't pay the fine and we were recognized by the FCC. No, the FCC said you were right. Yeah. We'll make a better standard, which they never have.
And everybody was, I know Johnny would have people on the air and not tell them they were on the air, but Kev, you did stuff within the lines. Professional broadcasters did not really break the FCC rules that much, did they?
Oh, yeah, I broke the rule. I knew I was breaking the rule. And but Larry had no problem paying the fine. What Larry's bringing up is a really good point. At that time, we're associated with Howard Stern. The FCC went from a $5,000 fine to a $200,000, $300,000 fine.
Wow.
And it, literally, that was a game changer.
And I will also add, it wasn't the fear of the fines getting so big as much as it was the fear of maybe losing your license if you got more than one.
Right.
What year did you get there, Kev?
I got about 1986. The Bears had just won the Super Bowl.
Yeah, because Kev was on overnights, and I was just weekends. And really, I mean, the FM side, I'm sorry, the Loop played some kick-ass rock and roll.
Yeah.
I will say that
absolutely,
for sure.
Yeah.
But the personality end of it, Kev, you were so great with your overnight loyal followers who just ate you up.
Yeah, you get that. Absolutely.
So,
well, one guy, again, Greg Salk, who is still, he's over at XRT now. Greg taught me a lot, and Greg is so responsible for the sound and the direction of the Loop. And I still use things today that he taught me. And I really appreciate somebody like a Greg Salk, who was really demanding in a great way. And he set the bar so high, I never wanted to lower that bar.
But you know what? You were a guy that took those chances and took those risks. And I hear these stories a lot about how people get on the radio. You were sending stuff in to Steve and Gary right. in the very beginning, right?
When you were I was so bored down in St. Louis. Right. I could do stand-up comedy, which I did, but I needed an outlet, and I was sending them tapes. Ron Reagan was president, and I sent the boys a lot of my what? Eat me. No, yeah, that was my release with Steve and Gary.
But then Jimmy called you. He flew you on a private plane with your wife to Chicago, and which was a smart thing to do, and really schmoozed you. And you weren't set on coming here right away.
No, I wasn't. I turned him down twice. He actually it was a United flight, but it was first class, and you know it was it just as soon as we landed and got into the Hancock Building, it the rest was magic. I felt very safe, and it was an asylum that I wanted to be a part of.
When did you realize that people started to get what you were doing in Chicago? It was pretty quick, wasn't it?
It was. I can remember when I went to the AM, I had to increase the power when the sun went down. And that's when we got into 32 states in Canada. And I thought, wow, I got to get it up. So I would ask women to just talk suggestively, and we would raise the power every night. And I'm like, wow, they're letting me do this. I'm fine with that. I loved it.
That's awesome. And you crosstalk. That was a big thing day, too, with Brandmeier and Steve and Gary, too, is on the way in and on the way out. Those crosstalks could last 40 minutes.
Oh, they were great times. Yeah. But also, you know, hanging with Larry, you know, when you're not in the station, I had my Larry's just became my best friend. And, you know, every moment inside the station and outside the station was just precious. And culturally, what was happening in Chicago at the time, not only with radio, but look at what the Bulls were doing to Michael Jordan and the Bears and culture. It was just a magnificent time to be in Chicago.
But then you talk about outside the studio, the golf outings, the proms, all the promotional stuff. I mean, you think about the radio, and you guys did a lot of that too. I mean, there were so many promotional things that you would do for a radio station that there's nothing close to it today. I almost think there's kind of a lack of creativity in all that. And it was the proms, it was the golf outings, and you guys were sharing with me last week about, you know, the fact that you got, you know, kicked out of 10 golf outings and golf courses and Larry's private club in 10 years. I mean, that's, but you were 12. You were doing some pretty edgy stuff.
Oprah Kills three times. Yeah. They gave us 2 second chances.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a wonder I didn't die of alcohol poisoning, almost happened. My first two weeks in Chicago, I literally almost had to go to the hospital. It was awesome. Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, Larry, you were telling me about an $8,000 bill for a Long Island iced tea.
Can you hear me? Yeah. I was, because we challenged Kevin and I on our first charity golf outing, challenged our bill, because we were just shocked by it. And when we went in, we thought we found a flawed billing part, and it was an $8,000 Long Island iced tea. They came back 20 minutes, they said, Mr. Ward, Mr. Matthews, I apologize, I'm sorry, but it turns out your friends, Ms. Thayer, ordered a caddy to go to Facebook and buy a garbage can, and actually there was 26 bottles of alcohol in that Long Island iced tea. And I think we probably could have charged you more.
Yeah, yeah. But Kev, you said you just ran into the priest that was at one of those outings, and he's forgiven everybody, right?
Father Smith. I did. A couple of weeks, just days ago, I was with him, and I literally asked for forgiveness, and he did. You know, Larry, one time, every year we would go out to Vegas because we would open up and christen casinos. And one time, I'm on the plane with Larry and Steve and Gary and Johnny and I think Danny, and we're flying out. And I can remember the pilot said, we're making our final approach for Las Vegas. Please buckle up. And I asked the flight attendant, I said, hey, can I get one more beer? And she goes, no, you drank them all. But the times we'd have in Vegas, Larry, remember? It was crazy what we did in Vegas.
Well, we can't talk about it.
Not at all.
No, it's off. Yeah.
You guys used to go out, Kev and Larry and Johnny B, and you used to call Eddie's show when you guys were out drinking all night. That was awesome.
That was great. I can remember I was in a limo with Brandmeier and Piranha Man, and Johnny just started tearing Piranha Man's clothes off and opened the sunroof and throwing his shoes out, his big Pakistani shoes out, and his pants and his underpants, and he was completely nude in the limo. That was horrible.
97.9, The Loop FM, 1967.
Fell out of bed. Well, when you come into Chicago, please come up here.
Okay, listen, Saeed, let me say hi to all the listeners in the region. Hey, you Chicagoites and all that. How you doing, guys? Rock on. And I'll see you when we get there.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay, gents.
Bye-bye.
See you around. Bye.
Bye. Yikes.
It's Paul friggin' McCartney.
Yeah.
Let's go to Fort Wayne. The Rookie and the Cookie, Delirious and Rookie. They're all together, goofy. The Jim Trunks family, they need a mausoleum. So all the kids can see them. You know they're off the deep end. The Jim Trunks family.
Boom, boom.
Dad! Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Dad.
Hi.
What's wrong?
Oh, I just had an awful thing happen to me.
What happened?
I went down to the store this morning and a bunch of kids, they took my pants down and they taunted me. They laughed at
what?
Me.
Whoa.
Ah!
What happened to you?
Is Miss Clausian, please?
Just a minute.
God bless you.
She is being married Saturday. And she will not be here today or tomorrow. She's at home.
Okay, well, the person that sent me this letter is going to get beaten up.
I'm sorry.
Do you understand? Do you know anything about Proud Mary and Celebrate?
No.
I represent the band. I'm an attorney at law.
Proud Mary, yeah.
Yeah.
Proud
Mary. And my band has a clause that says the Proud Mary clause. It says they must be able to play Proud Mary Celebration.
Uh-huh. Well, did she object?
Yes, she did object, and I am not, and I don't mean to yell at you, but I can't stand for that. Is she coming into work?
No, she won't be here today or tomorrow.
Would you call her at home and tell her that Jonathan Brandmeier, representing the Boner Brothers, would like her to call back right away, because there will be no wedding if we don't get to play those two songs.
Boner Brothers. And
wait, could you say that again to make sure you had it right?
B-O-N-N-E-R.
But I'd like to hear you say it again.
Boner.
Say it again.
Boner Brothers.
Say it again.
Boner.
Okay, what?
Boner.
I like.
No,
just,
you didn't. No, wait a minute. You didn't say it the same way you did before.
Boner.
Say it stronger.
Boner.
591 Rock, 591 Roll. We're here for your tax woes.
Yeah.
All night long.
It's ugly.
How are you today?
I'm fine under the circumstances.
What are these circumstances you speak of?
It's the saddest day of the year, is all.
Income tax day?
Yeah. It's so sad, isn't it? It's just terrible.
No.
Do you ever... I always wonder, like, as I'm writing that check, and I literally this year for the first time kissed the check as I put it in the envelope, because you're kissing the money goodbye, so I kissed the check and I put it in
I'd
the envelope.
I'd spit on it first, put a big loogie on there, and then mail it there.
Day Player on 720 WGN. We're talking about the final days of the Loop FM that we all grew up with the legends themselves, Kevin Matthews, Wendy Snyder, Bill Leff, and broadcast executive Larry Wirt. Wendy, I mean, we talk about the music of the station, too, because, you know, people didn't like the Loop at the end, but, man, that was a station, as you said, that rocked. And you were the first, like, one of the first female rock jocks,
Patty,
right?
Patty Hayes.
Patty was, yeah.
Patty
yeah.
Hayes gets full credit. She was the queen of rock and roll. I was the princess.
Oh, yeah, but I'll tell you, I remember, you know, I was in my first freshman year in college listening to you on the air, and I thought, how cool, and I could tell just by your voice that if I ever ran into you, you'd kick my ass.
Not if you lit my cigarette for me
back
then.
That's true.
But I went from the rock and roll end of things, which the Loop was the best rock and roll in the whole city.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hands down.
Yeah.
And then Howard Stern came to town on the AM 1000. I did live news inserts. And that's when I was put on Kevin's show. And the introduction to talk radio changed my life. So, Kev, Jack Silver put me on your show. And you just really, you opened me up, Kev. I got to say it.
Well, it was just, I loved working with all the people. I've worked with so many. Well, the one thing that I can honestly say, I wanted them to shine more than me. I had no problem bringing on the most talented people, because if you could replace me, do it. And I wanted people to just feel, I wanted the most out of people. And that's what happened.
Yeah. But you were, and I was reading your bio, you said you were passed around like an old, you know, you did Kev show, you won Gary, you said, in the divorce.
In the divorce.
You were co-hosting with Wendy and Tony. And then I think it was 95 that Bill, you joined forces with Bill. And that's when you started your 20-year-plus legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cool. So what, you know, you were a fan of The Loop, Bill, for
Huge
all those
fan.
Years, right?
Gigantic fan.
Yeah. And what were you doing at the time before you started doing radio? I mean,
I was doing stand-up.
Just stand-up.
Yeah.
So how did the radio opportunity come about?
I wanted to have a family. My wife and I wanted kids, and I didn't want to be traveling doing stand-up. And I would, whenever Danny Bonaducci was in town doing stand-up, I was his opening act, and we became friends.
That's cool.
And then Danny got a job, and one Friday I was guesting on the show, and he said, "What's up?" And I said, I'm going to stop doing stand-up. I got to find something local. And he goes, "Well, why don't you host a show here?" And I
That's amazing.
"Oh, okay, I'll start on Monday. That'll be fun." "What time do you need me to come in on Monday?" I'll be the host.
Yeah.
And he talked to Larry, and he talked to Matt Bisbee. He told him about me, and they were looking for somebody to go alongside Wendy late at night. And I used to listen to them when I would do clubs here in town. That was my ride home, was listening to Wendy and Tony. I loved it.
Okay. You listened to us fight?
Yeah, I would listen to you guys fight.
Was that what it was all about?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. And I had never met Wendy, but I'd heard her on the air 150 times. And it just, like, right off the bat, it
clicked.
It made sense.
So did you even meet before the show for just a little bit?
No.
No, you just really kind of went right on the air together.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And I do have...
Shotgun marriage. Shotgun.
Yeah, but this one worked.
Wendy knows this was a shotgun.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So how did you figure out the rhythm for your show? I mean, like, what did you just go on air and just start chatting and figured it out from there for the most part?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It was exactly that. Like Kevin said, we didn't want it to be what Kevin was doing or what Johnny was doing or Stephen Gary. It became very improvisational. Wendy's not, she's not trained in improvisation, but somehow just inherently knows all the rules of whatever said, run with it.
I learned from him.
Yeah.
Well,
seriously.
Thank you. But I mean, I learned how to do this. My pacing was a stand-up pacing. And Wendy said early on, you know, you have to make this last for 4 hours. When you do stand-up, you're doing it for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the rules are different when you do radio than
stand-up.
So
you learned a little bit from...
Oh, a lot of it.
Like I learned a lot from you, obviously, as well. Absolutely.
Thanks.
So I just got this email in that somebody's a little ticked who wanted to be on the show, who said he's a legend like all of you, and that's Jim Shorts. Jimmy, are you there now?
Oh.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. What's going on?
I could have added a lot. Larry, are you still there?
Jim, it's been a long time. I am.
I'm just saying, if you got to hit a ball, you might as well hit a ball. You know, I'll talk to you later.
Larry, for Jimmy. Yeah.
Larry and I are doing something on television. He is. Larry and I are working. I can't talk about it, but it's huge.
Oh. You're going to be on TV, Jim?
Well, if it's television, that's probably where I'm going to go.
Yep.
Good call, Wendy.
Thanks.
Wendy, he always told me that he was probably too good looking to just be on radio.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's true.
Yep.
It's true.
How's the casino over at Beaver Island doing? Is that
it's
doing
fine? Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I'm taking over where Steve Wynn, you know, look at his career.
Yeah, he's doing good. Jimmy, how's the boy? How's Luger? Is everything okay with your son?
He's fine. He's a growing man now in Sweden. He's gay. He lives. He does Olympic training. And
yeah?
He's a good man, yes.
That's excellent. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And you can get a lot of... What can you get up at the casino? You can get some... M80s, I heard, right?
I get M80s, medical marijuana, medical meth.
There's medical meth.
Medical meth right now, yeah. It's a good time. We're on an Indian reservation. Come on up, leave the kids home, bring them up. We put them in cars. It's a good time. It is.
Jimmy, do you hear this a lot? I'm sure a lot of the guys, the younger broadcasters, come up to you, Jimmy, and say, "You're the reason I got into radio." Do you hear that a lot?
I hear it a lot.
Yeah.
It's getting old now.
Yeah. Who owns WFRT now?
WFRT is actually the same group that's taken over the Loop. They're doing fantastic.
Is that true?
Yeah. It's not a bad move. I just think they paid too much, $21 million.
Yeah.
I'd say maybe 3.5 tops. Seriously.
That's fantastic. Nice talking to you, Jim.
Yeah, eat me.
Wow.
Right.
Isn't it ironic, though, that a Christian station has to take over for the Loop did to it? Is that why?
Just to kind of cleanse it out. Yeah, cleanse it out a little bit. Yeah. What's the legacy of the Loop? What is it going to be, Larry, to our generation?
Well, to the people who had it as part of their lifestyle and their day in the 80s and the 90s, and even in this last decade to some extent, although I think it really did change, I think it's just going to be a great, we're lucky to have experienced it, memory, right? It's just something that no one can take away, right? Nothing stays the same, but no one can take it away. Again, I just feel fortunate to have been just a really small part of it.
Larry, there's a movie on cable right now that is about the early days of the National Lampoon. I don't know if you've seen it, but I was watching those scenes where they're all in the office. It's all the head honchos and the brainiacs of the National Lampoon, all funny people together just making each other laugh. And when I watched that movie, it was so reminiscent of those days at the Loop.
You know, Kevin mentioned that some of the off-air was maybe even better than some of the on.
Yeah.
We would take trips, client trips, and spend time together and just giggle and just have fun. And, look, it was a pretty serious business. It helped grow a company, a radio company, that eventually became Clear Channel. Our two stations in Chicago became 430 stations.
Wow.
And you have to give Jim DeCastro giant credit for that, but it really was the Loop that gave us credibility with the bankers and to get funding to start growing. And just again, so many people were part of it. And Johnny, Kevin, Steve, and Gary, a big part of the profile. But as Wendy said, all of those great FM spinsters, if you will, Skafish and Stroud and Patty Hayes and
Sky Daniels.
Somebody that I'm just not even thinking of.
Sky Daniels, Terry Gibson, John Fisher, Mitch Michaels.
Yeah. And Larry, we don't want to leave off Liz Wilde, do we?
Oh. Liz Wilde.
Yep.
You may not like what he says.
But somebody's got to write a story about this, right? I mean, somebody's got to write a story about the Loop days. I mean, there's got to be something to pull together with all the memorabilia and stories that you guys have. I mean, I think there's a lot of people hungry for that type
of stuff. People love science fiction, Dave. They love it.
And I met my husband there, so I'm happy Jimmy Mack worked there
That's right. Kev, what about you? What is the legacy? What does the legacy of the Loop mean to you?
Methadone, kind of, it was a synthetic heroin. You know, and we are working on, there is a documentary.
Yeah,
now more than ever. It just, what it did, how it impacted culturally, everything. It really did. It was just that puzzle. And like I said, living in Chicago at that time, the Loop was just a piece of this puzzle, but it was happening culturally. You could never live that again because of everything.
Dave, you know what was nice during those days is whenever a kid would commit a crime, they'd show him on the news and he was always wearing a Loop t-shirt. That always made you feel good, didn't it?
Which, who has a box of Loop t-shirt in their basement or crawl space because somebody's going to make a fortune now?
I've got the M1000 suit. You know, they're selling them online. And on Facebook, they said they sold 2,000 yesterday because people are clamoring for them, I swear.
Wendy, you guys will remember, we had a store at North Pier.
The Loop store.
And when it shut down, I have most of that up in, like, my crawl space at home. So I think we should have an event, a charity event.
Larry, next year marks the 30th anniversary of the Gym Shorts outing. I think we ought to have an auction and have that, help out like a Father Smith in Maribel.
Oh, yeah.
Or something. I've got a lot, and I know Brandmeier and everybody else does.
I think I bought everything.
We argued about the T-shirt, whether it should say who caught one or who farted. And we argued about it for
strategic meeting.
And so, we printed both of them.
Yeah,
and it gave birth to Taste Like Chicken, which was another loop.
Exactly. One. Yep.
Jackass was my favorite.
Jackass was great. We got away with anything. We actually came up with a commercial. It was one of my first fights with Greg Salt because I got some video of the Dancing Robert, right? Joey Bag of Donuts.
Yeah.
And the way I got I got that video because Mike Watercutt was trying to show me something I could play at our holiday party and make fun of Dahl. And then, true story, and then all of a sudden, we made us laugh so much, I said, why don't we just make a commercial? And Mike said, why don't we? And the Persian Gulf War had just happened, and we wanted to put something on TV that made people just smile because it was just so, everything was just so down. And Greg Sulk said, what does that have to do with the friggin' rock station? I said, play any song you want.
Right.
Right? I'm giving you free marketing dollars. So he, to his credit, came up with George Thorogood and a couple other tunes, right? Petty. And all we did was play that video, play a rock tune, and then put up the loop.
Mm.
And it became a nationally syndicated commercial.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Robert got arrested.
Yeah, that, well.
Robert?
The Joey Bag of Donuts.
Oh, he did? Oh.
What did he do again, Lair?
He got so big and popular, on 4th of July, he started selling fireworks, but he had a menu of, you know, Joey Bag of Donuts with his video, picture, and he used maybe over-marketed. And the tobacco and firearms called me up.
Oops.
So, you know, we did. You know, we did. We just took that spot. We put it out again. We just changed the song to "I Fought the Law."
That's absolutely it. Genius.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. Wendy, what about you?
I just, honestly, that was my first real radio job, and just to grow up here in Brookfield, Illinois, listening to The Loop, and then all of a sudden getting to work there with the super celebs, really, Stephen Gary, Johnny B, Buzz Kilman needs to be mentioned, Kevin, of course.
Yep.
Jim Schwartz, not really so much, sorry. Hmm. But it was just so cool to work there.
Yeah.
At a place.
I heard it, bitch.
Oh, God, here we go.
Oh no. Wow.
What do you say after that?
I got nothing. No, it was just an honor to grow up listening there, and then to work there was really the coolest thing ever. It was a family. Come on. We all really did things outside of work together. Cindy Gatziolis, the late great, was amazing. Promotions were always fun. We all supported each other. It really was one big happy family.
But when I think of The Loop, and I'm just a fan in all this, I mean, I'm kind of honored to be even talking to the four of you, and I mean that sincerely, but when I think about The Loop and those early days, you're just a synonymous to me with Stephen Gary and John. Oh, yes, you are. Oh, absolutely. And again, I always thought you were going to kick my butt if I met it. How about you, Bill?
For me, because my training was not in radio, it was in stand-up, I felt like I was playing on the ultimate all-star team without ever having taken a swing at bat in the majors.
Yeah,
you know, I was on with all the names Wendy just mentioned. And it was just, I had to pinch myself. I'm not to suck up to the WGN family, but it's happened twice in my career that every single day I go into work, as I'm pulling into the parking lot, I go, how did this happen?
Yeah. And getting to do it with Wendy.
It's amazing.
And I mean that by doing radio, but for the second time around, that's pretty cool.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Well,
you came off that bench with no practice and hit a home run.
Oh, well,
I will say that. You fit right in. Seriously.
But you know what I mean by this. You had to hit home runs because you'd look at the lineup and you go, these guys are all hitting home runs. I better hit home runs, too.
It inspired us to be better every time we were on the
air.
Every
time,
Kev, you're doing podcasting at Dahl.com?
Yeah, and that has been fun because all these characters have grown, and it's great.
Hey, I want to ask a question.
Oh, yeah.
And Larry, you answer it, okay?
Jim, sure. I'll do my best.
Okay. Is that a wig?
Kev, I've showered and bathed with Johnny, and I don't believe it is.
Okay, there
That's
we go.
Answer.
You can't take the station off until you find out.
Okay, I'll work on that pretty today, Jim.
Of course, yes.
Hey, you know, we're trying not to forget people, and you talked about some of the great programming being the crosstalks, and I can't, you know, I can't help but forget Chet Kopic when Stephen Gary every night would go 5 minutes too long, and he would just get so irate because he'd have. And we all remember when Tony Lasorda was lined up, and he was ready to go, and Chet lost it, right? He just completely lost it, and we made a great promo of him losing it. but Chet Kopic was the pioneer of sports talk radio in Chicago.
He was.
A lot of people copied it afterwards, and, you know, we've mentioned Danny, but Danny's who filled in when we put on and took off Howard Stern. And Danny just always did an amazing job at the Loop. He did Car Karaoke, which was driving down the circular driveway at the Hancock and bouncing off the walls. That was expensive. But, it was indigenous to Loop people. Everyone did their own thing, but they knew what their base was.
You know, you bring up the fact that those shows never ended or started on time. You couldn't really time anything to anything that was on that station.
Well, Gary was always in preparing. Steve was always late. That was always an issue.
There's
no question. It was the thing. Look, what hit me, because I was a bit of a neophyte to radio when Jimmy brought me in, is that primetime was the morning. And then stations would have a big thing and they'd play music. But we had so much talent. I said, why can't we have primetime all the time? And we really did build that out, uniquely relative to other markets. I don't know of one that ever pulled that off and sustained that.
It's very cool. And that's where you guys were.
Yeah, we were on nights, first overnights and then 7 to 11, but Larry had the attitude of it's going to be morning shows all day long.
Yeah,
and
that
was
a success. No one turned off that radio. They turned it on in the morning, man, right. And left it on until they went to bed.
Although we would have gotten a better air slot if you would have gotten Larry Wirt's name tattooed on your butt.
I'm still thinking about it. I may do that, Larry.
A la Danny.
First time.
All right. Very good.
First time.
And Bill and Wendy, of course, every day at 10 o'clock here on WGN Radio. Thanks for hanging out, everybody.
Absolutely.
Thank
that
you,
was
Dave.
A lot of fun.
Thank
Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Kev.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Jim. See you, Jim.
Bye, Larry. You can edit the Johnny out.
720 WGN.
Hi, man. You making a promo?
Yeah. Brent Miller wants me to cut some promos for kids radio on GN, but don't tell Jack Silver I get in trouble.
Oh, let me hear. Now, this is over at GN.
They got kids radio over there now, but Brent wants me to do the promos.
Let me hear.
Hang on a second. Don't tell Silver I get in trouble.
Oh, who cares?
This weekend, it's kids radio on a whole new frequency. Following Orion Samuelson's farm report, WGN rocks hard with a salute to Megadeth. It's an ear-bleeding, gut-wrenching thrash-a-thon.
Telling you, GN's changing, man.
Kids radio. Tell your parents to go to hell, because we're going to kick some ass. Megadeth following Spike Odell. Saturday, Halloween night, we're going to pump some wattage into your pumpkins on your kick-ass station, GN.
It's one of them, I'm feeling so low.
All right, there's one.
That's good, man.
Well, that's that hard battle stuff again.
Right.